Maybe there is something that could be doing.
Okay.
4 months or 3 months, whatever it is.
You know, strange. Do we put switches in there that says the board has to appoint all these boards? You could go to your employer or these groups. I don't know how many there are, but then if that's even feasible, maybe might be worthwhile giving a call to the board saying, okay, what we listen to.
Good morning, everyone. This is Thursday, September 26th. It's the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. We are beginning now, and our agenda today is to cover a couple of subjects, an update from the Department of Human Services on state-operated services based on an audit that we reviewed in February, March of last year, and also a review of the Public Consulting Group report on the value of Minnesota healthcare programs, managed care, as compared to fee-for-service. Just as an introduction, I thought it might be important. I hope more members are here to have this conversation today. We made a commitment when we reviewed the auditor's report during session to come together again and offer the department an opportunity to talk more specifically than they had in the report at that time about progress they're making in relationship to the recommendations of the auditor's report. We appreciate the fact that the auditor is here today to help us if there are any specific questions. But we are also doing, aside from this hearing, periodic orientation and development workshops for persons who are on the committees of Health and Human Services in an effort to try to help us grasp more comprehensively the complex set of activities that occur within DHS, how they're funded, how they're regulated, what factors influence what we can and cannot do. And we've had a meeting already and are having another soon. But I would really recommend, and I hope that I'll ask the committee administrator to send out a special note to the members who would be here today, that reading these reports from the auditor on state-operated services, as well as this report that has come out on the value of Minnesota healthcare programs, provides great orientation to the history of these programs, how they've changed, the factors that they attempt to deal with as they provide direct services or as we try to fund these programs. For the value of Minnesota healthcare programs, the way that we structure the delivery of healthcare programs and how they're funded and how we try through the various recommendations and pilot projects to create better quality outcomes as well as increase cost efficiencies. So I certainly would recommend that as a part of this request that we've received from members of the Senate to improve their orientation to all of the complex subjects of health and human services and housing. So these are great resources, and it's a matter of you taking time to sit down and read through them. And anybody here who doesn't have access to these, I think you must. They're online. They're great reading. And I appreciate the effort that has gone into these reports. So with that, I'd like to just remind our group that's meeting here that we reviewed the auditor's report on state-operated services towards the end of the legislative session. Can't remember exactly when it was, in the Finance Committee. And at that time made a commitment to come back and ask state-operated services, whose name is new now. It's Direct Services Operations or something. I'm sure I'll get an update on that. As to the progress that's being made so that we can be assured that the systems are being changed in a way that there will be measurable improvements and outcomes in the deficiencies of our state-operated services. So with that, I would invite Ann Berry, who is the Deputy Commissioner for Direct Care and Treatment. There it is, Direct Care and Treatment. It'll take me 6 years to get that turned around. Direct Care and Treatment. And move through the recommendations, I assume, of the auditor's report and the activities of state of direct care and treatment programs. But perhaps you could begin by talking about the division that has occurred between the financial operations and direct care and why we have that new name.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Barry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. I'm one of the Deputy Commissioners for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. That changed in July of this year. The department now has two Deputy Commissioners, and I can start there at a very high department level. In your materials is a chart of the Minnesota Department of Human Services where you can see the commissioner and then the division with the two deputy commissioners. One of the deputy commissioners is Chuck Johnson. He is here today with us. And he has responsibility for the policy and operational aspects of the Department of Human Services. My responsibility falls in the area specifically of direct care and treatment. And the way I think of that as the equation is direct care and treatment is the sex offender treatment program and state-operated services. What we're looking at today is the audit report around state-operated services. Sometimes these programs get put together because we share a campus in one of our programs, but for a variety of other reasons, because of the populations we serve. One of our responsibilities is really to help you see where there are similarities in those programs and where we are in the business of direct care and treatment, and then where there are differences because of the population we serve. So today, the part of direct care and treatment that we're talking about is state-operated services, and that is and I'll spend most of my time on the legislative auditor's recommendations and where we are in making progress on those recommendations.
Thank you. May I just say that, and I know we've made you aware of this, that there has been interest from the members in reviewing the most recent reports that have been made in the newspaper about state, specifically the security hospital, the release of the patient and other other concerns to see. I think it will be important to look at that in the context of the auditor's report and how those situations, where they are in the timetable, where those incidences were in the timetable of your reforms, and then how what you're talking about here relate to those incidences reported in the newspaper.
Madam Chair, I have, in addition to the auditor's report, I have a list of at least a few things that I know have come up, questions that you have asked and others have asked for us to specifically address our comments. And I can just quickly run through them and then get back to the auditor's report and to make sure that I'm covering the things that you want us to cover. One is we've contracted for a root cause analysis on the client who was dropped off at the homeless shelter from our program at Security Hospital. The extension of the conditional license at the Security Hospital, I think, is something we should provide an update on. A lot of interest in staff injury, and we have some data on what the trends around staff injuries in our programs. The placement requirement that we take certain clients who are certain persons who are in jail and need to be sent to or in our facilities within 48 hours. We can give you an update on that. There's also a number of things looking forward. There were stakeholder groups that were created out of the last session. We can provide updates on those as well. This can take a number of different directions because there's a lot of interest in and a lot of issues around the programs. As much as I can, I'll weave them into the auditor's report because many of the findings and recommendations do relate to the issues that are also continuing to be reported on and continuing to come up. Just also then for the purposes of orientation, there's two sides to this organizational chart. You can see that one of the changes that we made when the commissioner asked me to serve as a deputy commissioner for direct care and treatment was to divide up what was state-operated services in one big program into three separate programs. And those three separate programs are forensic treatment services, and our executive director, Carol Olson, is here with me today. Mental health and substance abuse treatment services is the executive director, and that program is Steve Allen. He is also here with us today. And community-based services is run by Pat Carlson. And then on the far left side of your chart is the sex offender treatment program. The executive director of that program is Nancy Johnston. All four are part of a leadership group that, again, runs direct care and treatment in a way that brings us together where there are common points and then where there are differences in the population we serve, we operate in our program areas. We also provided some other what I would describe as orientation materials. One of them is marked draft because we're just in the process of, as a part of responding to the Office of the Legislative Officer's recommendations and findings, getting better at describing who we are and who we serve. I think it's a really, really important distinction that who we serve are generally people who aren't served by others, aren't served by other providers. We serve people who have mental illness, developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, brain injuries, or are civilly committed as sex offenders, and as stated here, have barriers to being served by others. And that barrier is generally a public safety risk. And we have really concentrated and begun to narrow our focus on serving that population. And there is a serious and desperate need to be able to serve this population along a continuum of services, both in institutional and congregated care, to all the way along the continuum to serving people in communities. Again, you can see the four domains of service. I've already talked about those: community-based services, forensic treatment, mental health and substance abuse, and the sex offender treatment program. There's also a map here that just shows you how widespread our services are. They cover much of the state. We have different kinds of programs across the state. That will continue as we have clients that are people that can be served by other private providers. We will repurpose the facilities we have to serve a more challenging and difficult population. You didn't get it in your copies. I apologize. We can make it available to you. But on the other side of this first page of the strategic plan, it's a longer document, not a lot longer, but a little longer, are some measures. And it's also one of the things that we heard from the legislative auditor's report. You need to do a much better job of measuring what you're doing. You know, what is success? If our success is to prepare people for successful community living, well, then we need to know things about how people are progressing in treatment, how many people return to our care, how many people are awaiting placement in the community. All those things are really important measures. We haven't reported on those measures before. That's what we're going to start to do now in response to the legislative auditor's report, but also because it's the right thing to do. With that, just as a really quick backdrop.
I'm asking our committee administrator to take that other side of the sheet and make copies for our committee so that they can see that today.
That's fine. And just it is in draft form, so it's still a work in progress, but getting feedback is very helpful, and so we'll look forward to that from committee members and other people who are here with us today. Let me move then to what was originally requested for the department to do, which is to go through the recommendations that were presented to your committee in the last legislative session and bring you up to date on our progress. So you are aware, we report to the Legislative Auditor's Office on a quarterly basis on our progress. The last progress report went to the Auditor's Office, I believe, in June, or at least began the process through our agency onto the Legislative Auditor's Office in June. The next one, I believe, is due, I'm told, in September or October. This will be an update from the latest materials that were given to the Auditor's Office. So the Auditor's Office hasn't seen this yet, because it's making its way through our internal process to the Auditor's Office. But we thought, because it's the most up-to-date information, we would share it with the committee members. So my apologies to the Auditor's Office if there's some updated information here that they have not seen. The first recommendation that came from the Auditor's report was to eliminate the Governing Board. We have done that. That is completed. There is no longer an outside advisory governing board. The board is governed by, or the operation of state-operated services is governed by myself, the leadership that I just talked about in the program areas, and we also have people from the department who are outside of state-operated services that can assist us by providing us with guidance and direction.
Excuse me. I'm sorry for interrupting you again. I'm just trying to think about how to make this a useful meeting for everybody on the committee. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to ask if you think it would be in our best interest after each recommendation to ask the committee if there are specific questions about that recommendation. I think it would help us maintain an order to the process, and otherwise the questions come from various places where committee members have an interest and we can be moving in kind of a fragmented way. So if that's agreeable to the members of the committee, if you'll think about attending. I know others are not here. We may have to come back over some of these things as people emerge for the meeting, but maybe the best way to approach this is to start with seeing if there are questions about each, after each, or some discussion about each of these recommendations.
That would be very helpful, Madam Chair.
And I did have a question on this. I wasn't sure if this was the first recommendation. This subject is discussed on page 27 of the overall report and had to do with an underlying concern about authority and responsibility. Perhaps when you approach these recommendations, if you could give some context out of which the recommendation has been made, it might be helpful, because I think the questions then emerge from that context. And in this segment, the auditor was talking about, as a result of the analysis, confusion that existed about responsibilities and authority and how that infiltrated all the way down to the service delivery level system. And we did hear, members of this committee over the years have heard consistent concerns from line staff about the confusion of who's responsible for what and the inability to get anybody to be held accountable for a decision-making process. So this is one of a series of issues, I think, that are of concern to us for direct care services in that I'm hoping that you'll speak to. This is just one that there was a board that was developed. There was question about whether or not it was allowed statutorily to have authority as opposed to the commissioner having full authority for all of the decision-making and operations and policy-making for the Department of Human Services. You're saying here that what has changed is that you've reconstituted this. My understanding is that there's no longer that governing board, but there is a new type of board. And I would be interested to know why that's better and why that isn't just replacing what was one of maybe several elements that created confusion in the decision-making process.
Madam Chair, two things. I'll respond to your question. I'll also need a copy. I know staff have a copy of the legislative auditor's report. I'll need to get it to refresh. Thank you. The sections that led, you know, that encompass all parts of the recommendation as well. So I will do that. It's not on the sheet in front of you, so I'll do it as best I can as we're going through the presentation. You are right. One of the issues was around accountability and being clear about responsibility as well. By changing the structure and creating a deputy commissioner position that is directly responsible for direct care and treatment, it more clearly demonstrates the relationship between the commissioner and all of these programs. With the creation of a governing board, probably 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago, there was this belief that you could break away state-operated services into its own independent, somewhat autonomous structure, yet the commissioner is still the one with the responsibility for running these programs. So what Commissioner Jessen has done is really to eliminate the governing board. And what we've done internally to meet all of our standards, like the Joint Commission standards or licensing standards, is there has to be some kind of structure that signs off inside the agency. So that structure is me and those who report directly to me and run these programs, with some assistance from people in the Department of Human Services who also report to the commissioner. The biggest difference here is we don't have people outside of the Department of Human Services running this program. And hopefully that addresses your question. Well, the difference was the former governing board was mostly made up of people outside of DHS.
the responsibilities that or the activities that might be engaged in by this new composition, internal composition, would be to review policies that are generally impacting all of the divisions. But as you said, these various Nancy Johnson, Carol Olson, and Stephen Allen would have unique characteristics that they'd be responsible, but those would also be reviewed by this board?
So we will have to have a couple of different structures because of different kinds of license that the department is under in all of the programs we operate. The reason we keep the governing structure is for things like licensing and credentialing of employees who work for us. It's a requirement of the Joint Commission. It's a requirement of other licensing standards. It doesn't have the same impact on the sex offender treatment program. So this just really is a group for state-operated services. There are also certain requirements that there's an annual abuse prevention report that's completed. We would review all and annual reports as well. So we would continue to review those. There'd be a narrowed, limited role for this structure, but they will have very specific requirements that are laid out for us by the Joint Commission. I can get you what that list is, but I know on them are things, like I said, licensing and credentialing of our workforce, for example, on an annual basis. Reviewing abuse prevention plans, and the other one being an annual report that needs to be reviewed.
And when you say you're going to review it, I mean, review might mean reading it reading the report, and then what?
Review and approval.
And if you don't approve?
Then it would go back to the program for with our recommendations about what needed to be completed to meet the standards or requirements of the report.
Now, I'm just going back to the overarching issue here is authority and responsibility, and what I understand to be a problem in the system from all of the various contributors to the service delivery is that there's confusion in who's responsible for what. And because there's this kind of a concept going on, that it needs reform so that there's clarity and so that there can – and there's also parts of this report that talk about how long it takes to review policies, how long it takes to get a policy changed, and how that leaves the line staff without a consistency in a sense of direction of how to function.
Mm-hmm. So one of
concerned about that in losing track then of the primary responsibility of giving patient care. So what about this new board assures us that there's more or that there is this rapid response, flow, accountability for decision-making in the system?
So we wouldn't use, Madam Chair, we wouldn't use this structure for that purpose. We have been meeting quite frequently, but a smaller group that included just the leads in these program areas met earlier this week to very specifically talk about their roles and responsibilities. And part of that group here is represented here today. They would be the authorizers and approvers on a very sort of quick turnaround for policies and procedures. A thorough but very quick turnaround on an approval for the policies and procedures. There's, as I said, there's two parts to direct care and treatment. One part of our area is the sex offender treatment program. And one of the things that we've heard from licensing, both from the Department of Human Services and Health Department licensing, is how well their policy structure operates. And it does. And so what we're going to do is borrow parts of that procedure and process and bring it over to the rest of state-operated services to create a more unified policy and procedure process that moves at a pace that is responsive to staff, that have policies that are understandable and readable by staff, that a staff person could know where to find a policy, pick it up, read it, and know what to do and be trained on it so that we actually accomplished what we're trying to accomplish. So one part of our structure, the sex offender treatment program, has what I think is a very well-established, very mature policy and procedure process. We've redeployed some of the staff, not completely, but taken their expertise and are now sharing it across all of our programs, which includes all the state-operated services programs. But I don't want to suggest that there won't What we do is complicated because of all of the different licensing requirements for the populations we serve. Just at the security hospital alone, we have three separate oversight and licensing groups, which doesn't include any of the boards that might provide oversight to the professionals who work there. So it does, we do our best to uncomplicate that for staff so that if I'm a nursing staff on the unit or if I'm providing social services on the unit or if I'm a security counselor on the unit, I know what my job is and I know what my responsibility is. And if I don't, I know where to go to find that information. So in answer to your question, a long answer, sorry, it's moving people from, you know, taking practices from the sex offender treatment program and moving them over to the rest of state-operated services.
I'll open this to others' questions. Just one more dual question. Are you going to be talking at some point more about how in this decision-making process there is a real concerted effort to engage the person on the ground, the line staff worker, in the contribution and creation of policy? And when you're talking about these licensing complexities, are you going to be speaking to those again somewhere in the review of this report? I think there is some reference to that in the report.
There is
the various kind of licenses.
There is another recommendation that deals specifically with the issue of the number of licenses.
Okay. I'll hold off on my question till then. But I know that there's a consistent theme of questions related to the people who work in the system, not a heavy-handed, top-down kind of, here's a new policy now, and it doesn't make any sense based on what we know to be practice. So, Senator Hoffman, did I see a hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have numerous questions regarding the report, and hopefully throughout your procedure of giving us information, some of those questions will flesh out. But I'm really stuck on this one, and I'm having a hard time understanding, you know, the efficiency of having that governing board. And it seems to me, and help me understand this, it seems to me it's pretty top-down. And I'll give an example. There was a few senators. Actually, Senator Benson was one. Myself, Representative Abler, Senator Johnson went out to Anoka Regional Treatment Center, and the discussions that were happening out there were very top down. Mm-hmm. The recommendations coming from staff were falling off the table, and finally it took us to have a 2.5-hour meeting with people out there, and I want to thank the commissioner for going out there and really addressing that. But when you started to see real things happen out there is when the frontline staff, who are experts, were being involved, and it wasn't top down. And I'm having a hard time understanding the efficiencies of an SOS commission if it seems to be top down. And I just want to say I'm hoping that throughout this we can make sure that we're involving those people that are experts in the field to help drive the system forward. I don't know if that's more of a question, but I really am. So help me understand how this is going to be more efficient than what you're doing now.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
there are really the most important purpose for the structure that we've created to govern, I'll use that word loosely, is simply because licensing standards require it. That somebody at the top, much like the Commissioner of Human Services or any commissioner of any agency, signs off and says these financial statements are accurate or these policies are an accurate reflection of the operation of our organization. Somebody has to be responsible and accountable. That's what this structure is there to do. The way we go about that business is by engaging people who work on the units, people who have expertise. If the people who serve the people we're responsible for, you know, for caring for, don't understand policies and procedures and aren't engaged and involved in the development of them, we will have chaos. We will have a mess. We will not be able to operate the way we want to operate. For your benefit, people I've had a long career in state service, but I started my career working at a regional treatment center. I worked on a unit. I fully understand what happens when you don't have a connection to those who are responsible for making decisions. And what you have is confusion, and then people feel less safe. People are uncertain about what they're going to do. It creates an environment of fear, all the things we don't want, all the things we're trying to eliminate and instead replace it with an environment where people are free to raise issues that they have, raise problems, so that we can address them. The structure exists, though, because somebody needs to be held accountable.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. It still doesn't help address my point. I mean, somebody needs to be held accountable. If it's a group of somebodies, then really it's not stopping with somebody or someone who's making. So I'm still a little confused. But I want to just bring up one thing. In the report, and I highlighted this, it will remain an ongoing challenge for DHS top leaders to devote the attention required by a system of direct care facilities. For example, devoting a DHS deputy commissioner position solely to the oversight or even making SOS agencies separate from DHS might simplify oversight and accountability. So there's some really good recommendations here, but I'm not seeing that help along the way. So.
And may I supplement that, Assistant Commissioner? I think I understand what you're saying, that this governing board is in place to review licensing requirements and making sure that you've met requirements that are placed maybe externally upon you in order to get a certain license or to assure that legal requirements are being met, whatever they may be, or licensing standards. And it may not be the right place in the report to talk about this, but Senator Hoffman and I and others on this committee are hoping that we'll hear more specifically. And I think since you've been in your position and others in these positions have grasped this problem, that the old system was created very little opportunity, or at least the listening. It was a very hierarchical system rather than a collaborative system, in which you get the best voices at the table to create, that you're not enemies of one another, that everybody's on the team and is interested in the care of the patient. That's the primary focus, not their own personal interests or comfort level. So we are very anxious to hear specifically how that system has changed. I know that St. Peter, that's been a discussion for a long time. Anoka apparently is having it more recently. So we need to know how the culture is changing. And if we went and asked staff satisfaction in a survey about, not that the outcome is perfect, but do they see a change in the culture around how decisions are made, what kind of an answer would we be getting?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. We currently do employee engagement surveys in a number of our programs, not universally across all of our programs. So the first thing we do is to do that kind of survey for all of our staff. And among the questions we're asked, you know, do you feel alignment? Do you understand your job responsibilities? Do you feel well prepared to carry them out? Do you feel safe in the environment in which you work? Are you involved in the decisions that impact you? There's a whole series of about 25 questions that we ask both at the Security Hospital, and Carol might be able to talk more specifically about that because she's been doing it now coming on 3 years. I know we do something similar at Anoka, but because these parts were all uneven and we're trying to bring them all together, we're going to do that across all of our programs, and what we'll get is I expect some really uneven feedback. In some of our programs, there will be real engagement with those who provide leadership on the ground, you know, our managers and supervisors who work in the facilities and in our programs. You'll see some real engagement. And in other places, you won't. But the standard is, what we expect is that you are involved, very involved. Staff are very involved with the leadership of the units, of the facilities, in how work is carried out, and agreeing on the goals and objectives that we have together. So that is one way we would get that feedback, and we're going to do that. We're actually going to do it department-wide across all of human services, but we'll be able to pull out what we find in each one of our programs for all of direct care and treatment after the first year of the year.
And that I would assume that when you discover that unevenness, that it won't simply be a discovery?
No, that's correct. Madam Chair, we have actually engaged the Management Analysis Division in the Department of Management and Budget to very specifically coach, work with supervisors and managers. It is a culture change for some. It is, some believe their job is to, this is what you do, and I don't want feedback. I don't want to hear what the problems are. Well, that's not the culture in which that we want to encourage and develop and spread throughout our entire organization. So, yes, it also involves coaching. And some people are well-suited to be supervisors and managers and really enjoy that coaching aspect of the job, that part of the job where you engage and work with the team that is responsible. So we know that the results will be very uneven across our programs. But I'd lead with saying, yes, a culture of one of active participation by all those who are responsible in the program makes us all better.
And I'm sorry to hang on this, but this is a critical issue that we're hearing about from our constituents. In this place that you've said where you recognize within the system that there may be people in places without the skill set necessary to participate in the cultural change necessary, do you have the ability and the intent to make changes in those positions? They might be mid-level positions or management positions, in order to place the correctly prepared or person with the correct competencies in those positions. Otherwise, you know, and this is another thing I've heard through the years prior to your responsibilities being taken on, but that this has been recognized, what you've just described, which has been the observations are made over and over, but the corrections are not initiated.
Madam Chair, my philosophy and strong belief after being a manager for many years is that people get an opportunity. We have to be clear about what our expectations are, and people get an opportunity to perform. If they don't perform, we figure out where they can perform and where they can reach their maximum potential. Not everyone is cut out to be a supervisor and a manager. And I think we've recognized, I think we have great supervisors and managers in the system as well as those who need some work or really aren't cut out to do that job. And yes, you're right. Then it is our responsibility in the next level of leadership position and then the next level of leadership position to support making changes where they need to be made.
Other questions on this subject?
Can I just add one more comment, Madam Chair? Senator Hoffman, you raised the one part of the findings and recommendation which spoke to the autonomous separate agency. As you're all aware, the Department of Management and Budget has released a report on the operations of state-operated services, and I would suggest that you take a look at that. One of their recommendations was one of the options is to consider an autonomous agency. We're not advancing that as the favorite option, but certainly it's been a discussion for many, many, many years in state government and these programs as a part of human services. I think we are where we are today because there was a period of time in the history of the department where a decision was made to really separate these programs from sort of the leadership of the department in a way that the responsibility and accountability fell somewhere else. I'd say overall, we've changed. That's what we've changed today.
Okay, thank you. To close this particular option off, the recommendation or the concerns about the governing board have the fundamental underlying problems that were created from that. Are they being resolved by the new organizational structure, and how are we going to measure that?
So my answer is yes, that we've addressed the structural issues that were part of the legislative auditor's report. That yes, the structural questions have been addressed. Who's accountable? Who's responsible? The commissioner is by statute. She has delegated the authority to me to run direct care and treatment programs. So I'm the responsible, accountable person within that structure. Your next question is, well, then how will we measure our success? Well, we don't have measures for the structure itself, but we can get feedback about some of the questions you've raised already. how quickly we are able to respond to problems, what we do to prevent problems from happening, how we our client
satisfaction survey certainly is a satisfaction feedback from the employees about whether or not the system is aligned in a way that they can understand their role. So is that going to be tracked as something that you as well as we can continue to have a sense of?
Madam Chair, yes. And the other one I would add is client satisfaction, client experience is another important measure for how we're doing as an organization.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You bring up a good point because I think out of the 18 performance measures that you do in your biennial report, I think you were only able to show data on two of them. So I guess the question out is how is this going to be any different than what your pattern of past practice has been? Because if there's – I hear this accountability, but yet I'm not seeing it. And so help me understand how that's going to be different in conjunction with our Madam Chair is asking. So –
Madam Chair and Senator, what I apologize for is that you got a truncated state strategic plan. You only got the front page. What if on the second page, and I think you may have gotten
second
copies,
page,
thank you, is if you were to turn that over, you would see that now we very specifically have the measures aren't here. They would be embedded in the document, and you could raise them up. We also have added, I mean, we're really moving into the second recommendation here, and if you don't mind.
Sure, we can go.
It's on developing performance measures and strategic plans with measurable objectives. This is one strategic plan for the entire operation of direct care and treatment, and we very specifically ask the question, how are we doing? So we're asking questions, for example, about how are people progressing in treatment across our programs. Those will be different measures for the sex offender program than they are for people who have mental illness or chemical dependency or substance abuse issues or people with developmental disabilities. Those measures will be different, but we do have a responsibility to move people out through treatment and, where appropriate, the least restrictive living alternative. That's what we measure. So we're going to look at the rate of progression in treatment. We're going to look at, well, what happens when something goes wrong? Well, how do we know something's gone wrong? Well, we know because somebody's involuntarily returned to us. And we can get even better at this because we have data from the department around Medicaid expenditures. Maybe there was a hospitalization somewhere else in the system. So what we'll look at, and some, don't get me wrong, some hospitalizations are appropriate for people who are living with substance abuse issues or mental health or developmental disabilities, but others are not. And so what we would do is we will start to track when people involuntarily return to services or very high-end services. It means something went wrong that we could have prevented. So, again, we're going to track that information for all of our programs. One of the biggest issues we face collectively is the number of people who are waiting to move into the community. They're ready to move into the community with the appropriate supports, with this appropriate security. We don't have places. So at Anoka, at any given time, about 40% of our population has stayed well past the amount of time they need to stay to address their mental health issues or whatever issues brought them, mental health plus other issues that brought them to our program. We don't have enough places in the community. The state is also undergoing Olmstead planning as a way to really begin to develop more community resources and way to support people living in the community. So another thing we're going to measure very regularly is who is in our service or who are we caring for that really should be cared for somewhere else, and track this on. We could track this very, very. This is very dynamic, so we should be tracking it monthly, because our need to flow clients through this system so they get to where they need and the kind of support they need is essential. And right now, it's not working. We have a lot of people in our care who could be served in other places. So we will be measuring that. And then finally, actually, I want to add another one to this list, but the client experience. There's been some work done in the department that very specifically deals with what is the client experience once they have moved from a more institutional environment to a more community-based environment or to an adult foster care environment, whatever that living environment is. And we've gone out and asked questions about, so what is your experience? So that would be another measure that we would include here as we move more people to the community. And finally, the last one I'd add, we're doing it, it just wasn't listed here, which is the engagement of our staff.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, thank you for the summary here of the report, and you touched on one of the things that I had highlighted, and I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that. And that is the fact that the state-run hospitals have a history of keeping many patients longer than necessary. And you gave the example of Anoka's beds, where 40% of them are filled with patients or clients or who could better be served elsewhere. And so it's good we recognize that. And you talked about the new metrics of measurement, which are needed and will be helpful. But what I want to know is, how are we going to get to the point where people are getting the care that they need at the place that they need at the right time? We have horrible delays in mental health services where individuals are leaving hospitals and cannot get the community-based care that is needed. And so while it's good to talk about the problem, it's good to have metrics in place, I want to know, how are we going to get the services to the people that need them in the time and the place that they need them? It's going to take more than measurement. And so I'd like to know, how are we going to go forward with this? Mm-hmm. And let me just add one other thing. I think I think we're all even more acutely aware of this issue with mental health based upon a number of the horrific events that we have witnessed in our country lately. And so I would like to know, here in Minnesota, how are we going to address this?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Senator. Last session, you provided the department with about $10 million to begin that process of the development of community services for some very complicated and difficult-to-place people in our system, maybe because they have high supervision needs or there's some sort of an issue of safety or a question of safety. And we have begun the process of working very closely with the counties. In our state, we're a state-supervised, county-administered system, so the counties do have some responsibility for the development of services. We can partner with the communities to build services. We have some of our own as well that we can supplement that county capacity. But we have started and this is anecdotal, but we have already started to deal with some really difficult cases that a client out of Hennepin County, for example, where there was some discomfort in moving this client back to his own home. He was living in St. Peter. Everybody agreed he was ready. He wasn't eligible for eligible for medical assistance because he has a home. But there was some concern about letting him return to his home. What the department did was to take this appropriation and this authorization with state dollars from last session to say and to work with the county and the court to say, if we provide overnight supervision, this man can live in his own home. So on a case-by-case basis, we are working. Now, this is reactive. It's not proactive. But on a case-by-case basis, we're going through all of our clients, both at Anoka and at St. Peter and in our whole service system to say, where are there other places this person can live? If there are other places, let's work with the county to move to those places. Where that capacity doesn't exist, we have to build it. I don't think I need to tell this committee, but and I think everybody knows that we get a lot of pushback every time we want to site a facility in a community. It's a very difficult issue. It's a very difficult problem. People with disabilities living in the community clearly has to be, with any kind of disability, living in the community has to be the goal for our state. To make that work, we're going to need more community placements. That process by giving us the resources to actually make that work for clients who are both at Anoka and St. Peter.
There is a task force or a group that's meeting to look at patient flow. correct? And mm-hmm. Is it a reasonable expectation that the outcome of that would be able to really make transparent what Senator Nelson is talking about, which is the gaps that are there, and maybe some analysis as to what contributes to that, or some suggestions as to how we might be filling in those gaps. We have backups. You're going to talk about the jail issue of immediacy and availability at Anoka for beds, and what that creates for problems in the rest of the system. So what Senator Nelson is talking about is a flow problem, access and flow problem, where people are held back perhaps in more expensive care because something's not available. Somebody can't get out of jail to get into the hospital because the bed's not available. It's a flow, what I call a flow problem. And there is a process going on right now to analyze that, to give better data to Senator Nelson and the rest of us on this issue, along with recommendations for change.
Madam Chair, there is continuing analysis. There's a very specific analysis looking at the state's capacity for specifically for mental health services and that continuum of services. They're looking at inpatient psychiatric hospital beds. They're looking at intensive rehabilitation treatment services. They're looking at the community behavioral health hospitals. What exists in the system to support people who have mental health needs, and how do we flow people it's counties, it's not-for-profit service providers, it's hospitals, it's us. Everybody's responsible for what that community capacity looks like. I'm not going to predict the outcome, but I don't think our own personal experience tells us that we have people who are ready to move into the community and we don't have places for them to live. And that we're going to have to build that capacity in the community if we're going to flow clients through and they're going to get to the right place at the right time to serve their needs.
Will you be able to separate out in that analysis, do you know, what delays in discharge or placement are occurring because of the lack of resource, and what is a lack of our systems tracking and being responsive to the patient? The incident, of course, is the woman who went to court. This is some time ago, 16 months in St. Peter, I think, went back to court, improper charting or inadequate charting. That's a very different flow problem or movement problem than the one we're talking about now, which is resource availability. Will this analysis of the flow offer a more complex understanding of what is contributing to this problem within our system as well as what we need to develop?
Madam Chair, it'll address the entirety of the system. So it will look at what capacity exists, what needs do people have, how are they being met or not being met, and all of the elements and the component parts that drive why the system does or doesn't work for some people. It's big, but to make it work for us, we'll also need to be able to separate out its parts and say, so what isn't addressed in our system? What is addressed in our system? I don't think that most of us would agree that this system is as comprehensive as it needs to be, nor are we getting upstream far enough. I mean, there are people with the right kind of supervision or community understanding of sort of the complexity and the acute and changing nature of certain mental illness, for example, that if we all more fully understood it, we probably wouldn't move immediately to hospitalization. We'd look for other ways to support people where they are before we would move to a very high-end solution. So this report will address those issues, but it will require us collectively to take action.
Senator Nelson, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, just a follow-up comment on even a more overarching piece. You know, on the one hand, the report that we're looking at today talks about how our state-operated services, in a sense, I kind of read between the lines that it might be too broad. In other words, they're doing things that are duplicative of non-state operated providers. So that's one hand, maybe spreading ourselves too thin. and doing things that could maybe be best done elsewhere. But then on the other hand, for those areas where certainly the state-operated services provides a unique function, and we should be really zeroed in on that, we're not providing the services that we need. And so I'm curious if there is a – have we had an analysis of our state-operated services? I'd like to know which services are unique that are not being offered in the private sector and which services are being offered elsewhere. And it would be good for us to zero in on that.
Deputy Commissioner, isn't there a component in here that relates to that that we'll be getting to, very specifically to – what is this whole historical discussion about what should be in the private area and what should remain under our direct service supervised. So I'll hold that part, if you don't mind, Senator Nelson, to that time. And then I would just this is a the second recommendation. We're going through the recommendations, by the way, for those who are just coming in, and then after each recommendation, trying to focus our questions to that particular issue so that we don't get too scattered in our conversation. So on the, my final question, I think, on this particular one is because I've been very interested in this for a long time, is analysis, the kind of dashboards and benchmarks that we make in order to really grasp what we're doing. And in the report itself on page 36, 35, and 36, it talks about, you probably know this by heart so you don't have to look, Deputy Commissioner, that the some challenges to what you're, what the measurements are measuring and whether or not they in fact get at all of what we need. I suspect that when you come here to us and we ask you questions about financing or about this or that, it becomes a dashboard somehow that you're going to measure so you can answer our question better. But my concern and what I think is exemplified in the auditor's report is that measurements that get at whether or not the service, whether it's in an acute setting or in a community-based setting or a preventative setting or a crisis center setting, when it's defined what the scope is for that function, whether or not the service itself that's being provided within that context is achieving its objectives. Are they measured? Are we able to see whether the treatment processes that we engage in are in effect effective? And are there challenges to decisions that have been made about the treatment approach that's being utilized for patients? You know, so I'm at the patient level now. Is the treatment itself for the patient appropriate, and is it achieving the objectives that it should for that setting?
So, Madam Chair, much of that is bundled up in the question about progression in treatment, the efficacy of treatment, what happens when we discover that treatment doesn't work on a very client-specific basis, isn't working for that particular client. What else do we do then to take a look at that person and determine what exactly they need to progress so that they can move into the community? So the answer is yes, we will be looking very specifically at treatment, the efficacy of treatment, along with people's progression in treatment. Now, this is maybe people don't know this, but one of the things that you know, certainly before Commissioner Jessen's time, one of the things that a decision was made in direct care and treatment was to really eliminate all of the quality improvement, continuous improvement, those people whose job it is to collect this data, benchmark it, share it for us to use to as benchmarks, as you suggest, as benchmarks and guideposts. We have slowly been adding. For a little over a year, we've had somebody in a quality management position. We've also brought somebody from another part of the agency to help us with, again, with the quality architecture, building our continuous improvement staff. I mean, it's not intended to blame anybody, but without those kinds of resources, it's hard to create enough so that we have that information. So we're rebuilding, and we've rebuilt. This is probably one of the most dramatic changes we've made in the organization, is to rebuild this part of the organization so that those measures exist and so that we have a way of determining is what we're doing working or not, and if it's not, what do we do about it?
I appreciate that. I think that that's correct, that if you don't invest in some resources in quality measurement, you aren't going to have quality measurement, and nobody's going to be paying any attention to it. So I think accountability lies in that. Mm-hmm. But my emphasis is to say, not only am I interested in because in the budgetary process, we're trying to make sure that we get people in the least expensive care appropriate to the level of need that they have, because we believe we can get some cost containment, and we can get stuck on that subject. But I also think we have to have measurements about those services that we have, in fact, treat people, that there is efficacy, as you say, in the treatment process. My experience has been that, and I don't know what kind of debate or dialogue goes around it, that at Security Hospital, for example, the focus was specifically to use medication to get medical containment of the patient, and that was the only responsibility in that setting. And I'm not sure, first of all, that it did it, and I'm not sure that that's the correct restriction of what the service provision should be, is to simply say we're here to somebody's medication management needs to be reviewed and intensely managed, and that's all we're doing here. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what I'm talking about. Is there a review, a consideration of what is actually supposed to be occurring in these institutions for the patients, other than sitting around and waiting for their medications to be reviewed?
So, Madam Chair, I think that we would all see really dramatic changes at Security Hospital, and sort of the person-centeredness in the approach to treatment, and that, yes, these measures, as we collect them, can be system-wide, but probably more important and more beneficial if they're done at the program level. And that our responsibility really is to treat to recovery and to treat to a place where people can live in the most integrated environment, which for many, many of our clients, whether it's at St. Peter or Anoka or at other facilities, is not where they are.
Okay, great. And Senator Hoffman?
Just as a follow-up, thank you, Madam Chair. The discussion with this recommendation, and I'm glad you're having this about least restrictive alternatives and about getting to the integrated setting. And when you look at the Olmstead decision of 1999, Minnesota's had a hard time coming in compliance. Now, I know there's a report that's either soon to be coming out, or there's a commission on this, but I'm not hearing, it brings concern to me when I don't hear that this is a priority for DHS, in the sense, because you said it's hard for us to get those community placements, involved. Yet, if we don't act now in a plan, progressive, thoughtful manner, I'm afraid you're going to have another black eye like Mito on your watch. And that's, Mito lawsuit was $3.5 million, and there was agreements there. You know, is Olmstead the next Mito? And that's what brings me concern, is if we're sitting here and we know what we need to do to comply with federal law, and I'm just not feeling the urgency from DHS to do that. And maybe it's just me, but that's just a concern that I have, and I would like us to hopefully address that.
Madam.
Yes. Go ahead, Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator, there is a remarkable effort underway, not just by the Department of Human Services, but being led by the Lieutenant Governor across all of state government to develop an Olmstead plan. I was part of the Jensen settlement for the department, and which was around the Extended Treatment Options Program, the MITO program in Cambridge. And part of our agreement was the creation of a statewide Olmstead plan. It was one of the plaintiff's requests, among many others, some of which we have complied with, others which are still in progress. But we've never had a challenge to Olmstead. I think that what this state has done to serve elderly populations, some of the developmentally disabled, some populations in the state has been quite expansive, and so that people have choices. Those who don't have choices are people with mental health issues, mental illness, developmentally disabled people who also have may have some interaction with public safety or law enforcement. Those more complicated people with shall we say, more than one diagnosis, more than one issue presenting to us in our programs are the population that we really have to address. And I agree, if we don't do a great job with the state's Olmstead Plan and make sure that things like employment, a place to live, transportation, a social life, all those things are available to everybody in our population, we will have failed.
In relationship to this specific recommendation, though, it would be about establishing measurements so that those are visible to see whether or not the initiatives, once discussed and discussed and discussed, I think this is what Senator Hoffman's point is, that court case, what year was that court case?
1999.
We're interested to see more than conversation and to see what the benchmarks or would be to measure that those suggested changes are, that we're seeing movement.
Just one,
not
just
perfection,
one more.
But movement.
I'm sorry. More additional. The Olmstead Plan, by its very nature, requires measures. Mm-hmm. Embedded and clearly central to an Olmstead Plan is that you measure. You not just talk about what systems needs are there, but you measure. So we will be measuring things like how the number of people who could live in alternative settings and aren't in those alternative settings.
Are we past the talking about this point? I think is this
the measures
are we at the implementation level?
Madam Chair, the plan needs to be approved by the court, and once approved by the court, we would bring it back. In the next session and begin implementation. Where we can, we've already started implementation. There are clearly costs associated with a restructured community environment that accepts and welcomes people with all kinds of disabilities. I don't want to sort of underplay the cost associated with this kind of a shift in the system. It's the right thing to do. It's what Olmstead requires of each state. It's what we've done for other populations. We just don't have the same amount of choices for other populations. So, yes, we'll be measuring it, and we'll also be coming back with some cost outlines. But it's due to the court on November 1st, which is when it will be prepared and delivered to the court.
Okay, now we've gone through two of how many? 20, and we have, 15 minutes left? No,
yeah,
I'm kidding.
Well.
We'll go till 11, so we have about 40 minutes. So I will try to check myself a little bit here and offer you the opportunity to speak. And it would be helpful if you could say what we're trying to correct with this. Well, this is the problem, and this is what the states both should do and what we've done.
So on the third item, which is we actually have touched on this, the policies and procedures are updated in a timely manner and one that is easily understandable by our staff. We really have touched on this. We are borrowing from another part of the structure where we think the policies and procedure process moves at the right pace, is responsive to changes in the system, and engages people in the process who are responsible for direct care in the units. The problem clearly was that our policies and procedures weren't understandable to our staff. We've talked about that already. I don't know if you want me to spend more time. We have updated a number of our policies. We've also shifted from every facility, every unit, every structure had its own policies or procedures. Well, we need something that clearly is more unified across our system. So we also have put people who in places of responsibility whose job it is to make sure that happens across the system.
Go on.
Okay,
number
so
four.
The next is to, this is really about placing clients from Anoka and St. Peter into the community. It builds on the last conversation we had about how we can move people who are in Anoka and St. Peter into the community. Again, you provided about $10 million in resources for the department to do this. We have seen a almost doubling of the number of people who have been provisionally discharged from St. Peter into the community, from Security Hospital, in our transitions program into the community. We've worked closely with counties to make this happen, particularly Hennepin County. to make that up, we've used what we call an escalation up process. If somebody's ready to move into the community, now this is on a case-by-case basis, so I'm getting to a level of detail here that maybe more than what people want, but it's how we're getting this done, because people are in our system and stuck in our system for a reason, and that reason generally is the community isn't prepared or ready to care for them, so we supplement in each one of those cases so that somebody can move into the community when they're ready to move there. I will admit we've had much more success with Security Hospital and our ability to do it there in the forensic services programs on the St. Peter campus than we have been at Anoka. And so we're doubling back and taking another look at, so what is happening that we can't move people out of our program in Anoka, our facility in Anoka?
Do you have any preliminary, you don't have to give a absolute, but I, Deputy Commissioner, I was elected more than 7 years ago, and Senator Berglund was chairing the Finance Committee at that time, and this was the conversation then, that there be a response to a request for a plan to do these things, and I don't think that report, according to the auditor's report, was due within a time frame, and we still haven't seen that report. So
Madam,
maybe that's because we didn't appropriate any money to help you accomplish that. But,
Madam Chair, the report is underway. It's actually being led up by a staff person in the department who is reporting both to state-operated services and also to the chemical and mental health services area with Dave Hartford's leadership as a way to really bring together the entire systems issues around Anoka. When Commissioner Jessen reminds us when she came on board, one of the things she heard was, what about the closure of Anoka, which, you know, of course would surprise us all given the position we're in, that we can't, that there's a need for that level of care. People are trying to get to it and they can't get to it. We know that a couple of things are impacting our ability to flow clients through and out of the program. There is a consequence associated with placing people within 48 hours from jail. And we've only been at it for a couple months. We've been able to make these placements within 48 hours, but we are doing more than what is required under the law. So we have placed people who were waiting in jail, might otherwise been served in other service systems, but they're first in the queue in our program. And there's a wait, and there's beds associated with doing that.
Stop there. That might have been served. What you were saying? Could have been served in a different way.
They could have been served. I mean, there are counties in this state who provide services to clients who are waiting for court action or
commitment action when they're in jail.
Mm-hmm. Or there might be another place. I know that, for example, in Ramsey County at Regions, they've set aside a part of their facility to serve clients who would otherwise be in jail in their system. So there are different solutions and different alternatives. But in an effort to really comply with the requirement that was added last session and to do a really, really good job, we've probably taken more clients out of jail than we were required to do under the statute.
Just to make sure I'm clear, because I was in judiciary when this conversation came up as well, is the consequence of this law, the problem was that we were using jails for psychiatric containment because there's not enough, I mean, it's a flow problem here again, and here's right. One of the outcomes. We've got mentally ill people in psychotic states being jailed instead of treated. And so what I've heard you say is that some counties dealt with that, recognized that, and dealt with that within the correction system. And others did not. So we've created a system now that allows any patient within 48 hours to be hospitalized as needed at Anoka, and that has put beds on reserve for those patients that were before available for others throughout the state to utilize that were not coming through a correction system. So there's a backlog there. Is there also now a change in those counties that were providing that service to rely on this new law and an increased pressure then to use NOCA or a state-operated service facility to manage that patient in a treatment center rather than in the jail system.
Madam Chair, I think it's too early to tell. I mean, we've been doing this now for, this is the third month that we've been accepting clients. There is a wait associated with the compiling each new person that, and they have to be committed to, they're supposed to be committed to the commissioner before they come to us. But have county processes changed so that more commitments are making their way to the commissioners that would not have otherwise been made? I'm not prepared to
okay,
address
but this,
that
so
today, but that's something we didn't analyze.
This has to go through a commitment process.
They do have to go through a court commitment process, yes. But that we don't have. We're not a party to commitments. The state isn't. It's the county, and the county goes to the court. And I know this is something we've talked about, Madam Chair, that because we're not a party, we're not notified. We have no way to intervene and say that this person might be more appropriately placed or cared for somewhere else. And then they're committed to the commissioner, and then we're notified of that commitment.
And is there something being done to try to align those systems so that that doesn't happen?
Well, we're early in the getting ready for the legislative session process, but this is one of the things that we currently have on our list of items that we would like to bring forward at a minimum. If we were a party to these commitments, we could seek alternatives. We could look for alternatives. We could go to the court with potential alternatives. So again, we are not using what is a very important and essential resource for this state for the wrong reason.
Any other questions?
There's a number of other things we're doing specifically with Hennepin County in the development of intensive rehabilitative treatment centers, you know, filling in some of those treatment gaps in different parts of the state. You know, we're trying to build as many of those or authorize as many of those as we can. We only operate, I think, two or three of those programs. Most of those are operated by private providers across the state. The next topic is around injuries in the workplace. There is a chart in your packets that looks at system-wide injuries. Here's a place where I would say there's been some really uneven progress. We saw a rather substantial spike in injuries. This is a chart that shows you a number of things. It includes every time an employee fills out a form that there's been an injury or an illness related to work. Then there's something called OSHA recordable cases. Those are cases where somebody is out of work for an extended period of time. So many of our staff might get bruised or there might be some injury that comes on the job, but they either stay on the job or they're back on the job pretty quickly. But we do have staff where the injury requires them to be separated from work for a period of time. Those are what we report to OSHA. Workers' comp claims are where the injury was so serious that obviously somebody is receiving compensation for the injury because they cannot work in the same position they had previously. And finally, the purple line, hopefully yours is in color, is the number of assaults. Now, assaults don't always lead to injuries or OSHA recordable cases. So, but these are the questions that people ask us about when they're asked, well, you know, how dangerous is it? And what do you doing to create a more safe work environment? So underneath this comprehensive data is a program-by-program data. So we can look at the trends in every one of our programs. So what we did is we asked labor and industry to send their OSHA consultation team into one of our facilities, and it's the start of a relationship with OSHA so that they look for problems. They meet with staff. They say, what is it about your job that you believe is dangerous? What can we do to create a more safe work environment? And all of those recommendations make their way to our leadership group and our managers and supervisors so that we can respond to, again, what we need to do to very specifically address workplace safety issues. It's been a great partnership. They just finished up their first report. Well, they're not done with it. They just finished up their first visit. We're now picking the second facility, second and third facility that they'll be going to, but this is an ongoing partnership with them. Again, in investing in getting others who can help us improve our rate of safety, and by looking at our own problems very comprehensively, again, working with staff, how do we create a safer work environment for our staff and for our clients? I didn't say this, but some of these assaults, This is very specifically employee injury and illness notification. But we do have data on assaults, you know, between clients, and we also have a responsibility to make sure our clients are living in a safe environment as well. So we track this information. We track it on a program-by-program basis. We've invited or we've partnered with the OSHA consultation team, the technical assistance team. They've come to one of our facilities. They will keep coming to facilities. They work directly with staff with us on how we create a more safe working environment.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And although I appreciate the judicial work that you're putting in dealing with these issues, we saw firsthand in Anoka just what some of the damages were to staff and some of the unsafe conditions that were created. But I'm hearing, once again, Madam Chair, a very top-down approach. I'm not hearing anything within the Deputy Commissioner talking about the staff being involved in this decision-making process and solution-based. We know that over in Anoka, there was a safety specialist there that it was a direct line worker who was a wonk when it came to understanding what specifically needed in there. And some of the issues that were faced were mandatory overtime at 78 hours in a two-week pay period. But I'm not hearing how they're including some of these experts that are already within the facilities that could be at the table helping you problem solve. So help me understand how you're utilizing direct line staff in that case.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator, maybe I wasn't clear. The OSHA partnership process very specifically engages staff in the process. That's the heart and the core of the process. Is leadership isn't engaged and involved in that process. They come on site, work very specifically with the staff on those units, and the safety staff as well, to they ask the questions. If leadership and others aren't around, hopefully staff will feel free to talk about those things that create unsafe work environments, whether it's the policies and procedures are unclear, whether we don't have the equipment we need to do our job, things are broken, we shouldn't be taking these kinds of clients in our facility. I mean, they can run the gamut, but it really does start with staff. So if I wasn't clear about that, I apologize. But it really does start with staff.
Does this initiative with OSHA result in a description of what are contributing factors, or does it involve those line staff who have now described what they perceive as contributing factors? Are they involved then in the next step of continuous improvement and designing a response to those identified problems? I think that's what Senator Hoffman is asking about.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, then the follow-up is the technical team works with us and our safety administrators that are on site to make sure that they understand that not only, as you described them, the contributing factors, those things that contribute to an unsafe work environment, but that here are the solutions that we can agree on and don't offend any licensing principles, for example. I mean, there are some boundaries around what we can and can't do. For example, we in many of our programs can't seclude clients, which could maybe create a safer work environment. But so within certain boundaries, we would work with OSHA and their technical advisors to develop these solutions.
The people on the unit are involved in this problem.
I'm sorry, I use we as a forgetting who I am and what I do. But the people who work in the facility with the leadership of that facility, in some cases there's 16-bed facilities, it just depends on where it is. Like at Anoka, it's a much bigger place. But each program has its safety administrator and its responsibility for making sure then that those solutions are driven and communicated, driven by staff concerns, working together on those solutions, and then developing a plan of action around those solutions.
And you are designing a survey, a employee survey, that would extract information for you to determine if they, in fact, believe that is happening, that they are participating at that level.
So, Madam Chair, as a part of the engagement survey, we do ask we do ask one question about safety. We've expanded that to three. So we very specifically be asking questions about, do you feel safe? You know, do you feel you have the tools you need to do your job, which is, you know, which is part of a safety question. But I'm not remembering the other questions. We certainly can get them to you. But we wanted to emphasize, in fact, probably overemphasize in a 22 or 23 point question, a series of questions, the issue around safety.
And I would just hope that you can hear what I'm saying here, that those questions, I'm not saying that you aren't doing what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. but those questions wouldn't measure that. They would give the subjective feeling of the person about safety, but they wouldn't answer the question of whether or not they felt they participated in creating the solution.
Thank you.
Okay. And then Senator Benson.
Just with regards to the chart, I see an absolute count, and this is in no way to denigrate the work that is being done here, but what I don't see is a consistent baseline. You know, do we have more employees or fewer employees? Because as we're looking at the trend getting worse, if we have fewer employees, then actually we have a bigger problem. And so I guess this would have been helpful as a percentage of employees or some baseline number of hours that are worked by these employees so that it helps us put things in context. I would imagine that we have a consistent baseline of employees, but I don't know that from looking at this.
Madam Chair, there have been some changes in employment numbers. We certainly, and I agree, yes, for the purposes of perspective, what does this mean, especially if you're seeing large decreases in the number of clients or number of staff. We aren't at this point in time. We've been relatively stable staffing of at least for the last three years. But there's no reason not to add that. I think that's I think that would add a lot of value okay. to this information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Did you have a follow-up question? Then we'll move to the next. Or did you, Senator Marty? Did I miss you? No. Senator Hoffman.
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to hear about the process, Assistant Commissioner, but I'm still not – when you see words like indifferent and disregard, and when you look at, you know, there's a special unit within the unit that does investigations, and the cases went from, you know, 148 in 2009 down to 30 in 2011, it still doesn't get to the heart that I'm trying to get across here. And there was a former safety person at Anoka who had more acronyms after his name, understood this better than a lot of folks, and nobody counted on that person's for it. It took us to bring that to the attention of the commissioner. And so my question to you is, process is fine, but get to the heart. Tell me what you're really doing with those folks. You have experts within your own department that are not being utilized, and I'm not hearing that anything has changed or anything is different about that. And so if I'm sounding critical, I am. So, you know, help me understand what's different.
So, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to specifically talk about each one of the programs. Anoka is actually trending in the right direction.
I think that we won't be able to use our time that way today.
Okay.
But I would appreciate if there's a specific instance, as there appears to be, that you be given that information and you give Senator Hoffman a very specific answer to that specific situation. But in a general sense, you're hearing our concern that the cultural change from a hierarchical to a team collaborative approach to not only providing care but to an analyzing problems and creating solutions is something we'd like to hear not about conceptually but in practice, and how do we know that in fact happens. I think somebody can be missed, not invited occasionally here and there, that might have been, like to have been a part of the process, but and you can look at that specifically to see what fell apart in a specific situation. But for us, I think our interest is in making certain that we've been heard and that the employees have been heard about their sincere desire to be a part of the solutions, not just describing the problems and making complaints. Because then they get perceived as complainers by the system instead of, you know, contributors to the solution. Okay. Can we move from there?
Sure. The next, then, areas around designating a senior administrator to monitor and oversee restraint and seclusion practices throughout the organization. We have done that. The issue here is that there was no one person in this system looking across the data around restraint and seclusion in our system, and that we could lose track, like we did at Mito, around the number of times and the duration of both restraint and seclusion in our system. We have someone who does that. We have someone who tracks that. They look for trends. They very specifically look at client data to determine if, in fact, somebody has been restrained for longer than, I think it's longer than an hour is the first cut. But overall in our systems, we have seen a dramatic decrease in the use of restraint and seclusion across all of our systems. But it is still Donna Buddy. She is our quality officer. It is her job to monitor that on a regular basis so that she brings issues forward when she sees problems and to make sure that we prevent those problems over the long term.
Okay, go on. Seven. Overtime.
Should seek ways to limit overtime use as a reasonable level. Well, the first there were two big issues in our programs, both at Anoka and St. Peter. The first thing was understanding what was the cause of getting to the root cause of overtime. One of the big issues at Anoka was using temporary staff, part-time staff, which we have since corrected, I think pretty dramatically. We have added more than 20 full-time staff to the Anoka at Anoka. We've done the same at St. Peter. At St. Peter, at the forensic program, we also incorporated some scheduling and shift changes. That was done in collaboration with staff who were working those shifts in units. So at the two programs where we had the most serious problems with overtime, we've only begun to see some improvement around the amount of overtime that's being used. But as those positions, are fully rotated into the schedule, it takes us some time to gear up. We spend a lot of time training and getting staff ready to work on the unit. So, but we've seen some changes there, again, because we added staff, and we moved away from using temporary and part-time staff. That's not how we see ourselves as an employer of choice. And at St. Peter, in addition to adding staff, we've also made some shift adjustments, again, in collaboration with the staff there.
Number eight.
Oh, very good. Well, this isn't ours, but this is should amend statute to give district courts continuing jurisdiction over all individuals that are civilly committed. This is an issue.
It's okay. I think it's in process. There's a 2015 due date. I think that because of our time, we could probably pass over this.
Okay.
Just not lose track that there needs to be some amendments made. The process is in place to make a recommendation for legislation.
The next is a question of people who are committed to the commissioner but duly committed to someone else, generally a health system. It was determined by the auditor that there are cases of commitments to the commissioner that we weren't notified of. We've since worked with the state court administrator, and we have a solution to that problem, so we will now be getting that information. Don't need to see a law change. The state court administrator has agreed that they can make this information available to us at the same time they make it available to the counties. So we will now start to get all this information on all commitments to the commissioner. It's almost
what problem
completed.
Is solved with this? Could you remind me of the problem that will be resolved with this change?
Well, we had people who were committed to the commissioner, but we didn't know about it. So they were duly committed, maybe to the commissioner and to Hennepin County Medical Center, or duly committed to the commissioner and a private chemical dependency treatment program. They were committed to the commissioner, but they weren't in her care. They weren't in one of our programs, and we didn't know about them. So this way now we know about all those people who are committed to the commissioner.
And by knowing about them, what better outcome can we expect?
The use of ANOCA is a great example of the use of the commissioners to the commitments to the commissioner. If we know that somebody's committed to the commissioner but they're somewhere else and possibly on a path to, say, ANOCA, for example, we can do everything we can with our staff who work with counties in the community to make sure they're supported where they are so they don't have to come to ANOCA.
I see.
So if we're aware of it, we can do some upstream work.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? 10.
All right. The department should periodically test the accuracy of firearms-related background checks. There was some problem with some errors, so we now have instituted a second level of review to make sure that any of those errors that were found in the auditor's report are corrected, and so that the accurate information is being provided to local law enforcement. This will never be completed. It will be an ongoing, I mean, the process has changed, but we still have a responsibility to make sure that this is always accurate information. So, like with many other internal controls, adding a second level of review as a way to assure that the information that's provided is accurate and that all of the data that's available to us is used to make sure that we get accurate information to local law enforcement.
Number 11.
Number 11 is one in progress. DHS should clarify what types of disorders are best treated at the Minnesota Security Hospital. This really gets at the issue of who we serve and are we the best place to provide service for some of the clients that have been committed to the commissioner and to her care. We have begun the process of defining, now I know this is early, so it's going to sound simply that we're thinking about this, but we're not. Dr. Pratt, who is the medical director at State Operated Services, has advanced to us a proposal that would vary, that would limit the population we serve or that we are best at serving. We want to bring it to a stakeholder group that was created by the legislature around clients that are mentally ill and dangerous. It was created in the last legislative session. And one of the things we want to do is bring it to that group to begin not treating persons with certain kinds of disorders has consequences. If we don't treat them, who does? And so we can't advance this definition of who we serve without having a conversation with others who provide service the way we do. Hopefully that makes some sense to you. So we're early in the process. We have asked our medical staff and our psychology staff at Forensic Hospital to provide us with a definition. They've done that in a draft form. I didn't bring it today. We could make it available to you. It's very early in the process.
Two questions. Who's on the review group that you're talking about? And if the definition of the scope of who do we serve best, whatever that definition is, do you anticipate that that's going to create another gap in resource available to people for referral?
Madam Chair, I can get you the list of that stakeholder group. I don't have it in front of me.
They tend to represent, be what kind of persons that are?
Oh, they represent NAMI. They represent the healthcare system. They represent Consumer Survivor Network. They represent, I'm trying to think of all the people who are on the group, law enforcement, anybody who partners with us. Down at our program.
And who would be affected by a decision about the definition of what the service is that's provided at Security Hospital?
I think law enforcement.
Yeah.
And public safety and law enforcement and corrections, and they are all represented on the group as well. So this is really about, again, this is not my area of expertise or something that, you know, we'd get other experts to talk about the type of clients we're talking about, but they're not clients who are amenable to treatment and the kind of treatment that we're using in our treatment programs. If you want more, we can talk a little more about it, but we're so early in the process, I'd feel more comfortable coming back.
I'm okay with sort of coming back at this, but I think that if I heard you correctly, you're talking about defining who, like at Security Hospital, do we best serve, and that defines who gets referred there.
Right.
And then maybe there are people referred there that are not best served there because of how you define what your job is. So I am interested to know that there's that question of, is the definition correct? And then if everybody agrees to that definition, who falls off the plate and where all those players that are in your task force are corrections, are they going to have more, you know, are we creating systems problems because of a definition? And then what's the plan for addressing those system problems? That would be my interest in that.
Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll agree with that as well. The interest also, you have two different populations that you're trying to serve, and how do you differentiate between those that are developmentally disabled with the cognitive, lifelong cognitive issues, or those that you know have the mental illness? And throughout your discussion, I'm not hearing partnerships with people like the Governor's Developmental Disability Council, our own state ombudsman with mental health. I'm not hearing those names in there. And so what are we doing to address? And I see the recommendation in that specifically, we're talking about page 105. The recommendations within there are to really to look at the differentiation between those cognitive mental illness, because if you're putting them all in one, you're not going to win. I mean, you got to be able to, and people with developmental disabilities should not be in a state hospital.
And so there's, besides your perspective on that, about
correct,
dividing those populations, I think the question is this group that's reviewing this reflective of those groups as well as other groups who will be impacted by these decisions?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes. I didn't get through the entire list because I couldn't remember them, but certainly the ombudsman. We work very, very closely with the ombudsman's office and CleanWIC and her group on the Council on Developmental Disabilities. And under the Jensen settlement, we are, except in very rare circumstances, we do not place persons with developmental disabilities into the forensic program. The only reason they would be there is because they have a predatory sex offense in their history. So, and we agree. We are doing everything we can to move clients out of both Anoka and St. Peter with developmental disabilities.
Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, I'd like to see some progress on that because that's not consistent with my current understanding of what's going on. So, and I want to get deep in the weeds. I know we get time, but I'd like to see some progress on what she just talked about.
Yeah. Offline, maybe you can talk with Senator Hoffman about that. You know, our time has gone faster, and I'm really appreciative of the time we are spending on this. But we have another report, so I am thinking that maybe you want to go to the specific current events and give us an update on that, if you don't mind, Deputy Commissioner. And if you would be willing, I know you have fabulous, all the people that you've brought here with you, and I don't know if it's unreasonable to ask you to come another time to help us complete this list, because I'd like to get the current update, because members of the committee have asked about those things. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity. And I'd also, even though the time is late, like to ask just our auditor, if you would be willing. Is he still here? Yeah. Or somebody from to just give us a sense of whether or not in the reporting process you feel as though we're on track from your perspective as from the auditor's office, just real quickly. And then we may reschedule again to complete the remaining items.
Sure.
Not only is it helpful for us to see what changes you're making, but it is an orientation for all of us to all of these various elements of the system. So thank you for that. So update on the current events, and then if the auditor's office would just give us a little taste of what you're seeing.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I think having gone through this first part will also help us prepare for another discussion about the items on the list here. We can present them in a slightly different way. Other issues. Specific I wanted to talk about was the client from the security hospital who had originally been committed to Anoka as mentally ill was transferred to the security hospital where we typically treat people who are mentally ill and dangerous. We missed a court report, and as a result of that, the commitment to the commissioner lapsed, and we no longer had any authority to continue to hold the client. We were able to keep them through the weekend. We worked with the county on the appropriate placement. There was no placement. Our staff then brought him to the Twin Cities, and he was discharged. Well, he wasn't really discharged. He was discharged from his commitment. He was left at a homeless shelter. We have hired an outside root cause analysis expert who is just finishing up her report. I just saw an email yesterday. She's just delivering the report to Commissioner Jessen, so I don't have it ready and prepared. When it's completed, you will see it. You will see her job was what were the systems failures? Were there Were there people failures? Mostly, though, we were looking at what were the systems failures. And we knew some of them right away. We knew one of them was when you transfer somebody from Anoka, where they have a commitment for mental illness, and they're reviewed on a very regular basis, to a program that mostly serves clients who are mentally ill and dangerous and are not reviewed by the court on the same regular basis, that, you know, it created a mess. But she will most likely find other things as well. So when it's complete, you will get a copy. You will see what's included in that report and her recommendations and findings, which we will use just like we use the legislative auditor's report, which is to build a plan of action to address the problems that she raises.
Anybody have anything more on that? Thank you. Go on.
I'd also like Carol Olson just to join us very quickly. She's the executive director at Security Hospital, to just talk very briefly. As you are probably well aware, we had a 2-year condition on our license following a substantiated report of maltreatment from our program of over a year ago. The department determined that our license would be conditioned for another year. So I just want Carol to talk a little bit about some of the events surrounding that and then now what we are doing.
Madam Chair, my name is Carol Olson. I'm the Executive Director for State Operated Forensic Services. Yes, in the end of August, we received an extension on our conditional license for an additional year. So that would goes through December of 2014. It was precipitated by two events that occurred at our hospital. One was in August of 2012, where there was licensing determined that there was neglect of a patient that occurred, and also an incident that occurred in January where there was, again, neglect that was substantiated. Both on our facility as well as a couple of our staff at our facility. What I can tell you is that both of those instances were discovered by our facility. We reported both of those instances, as we have continued to report any instances that we would like licensing to come and take a look at. And we also investigated both of those instances at the time that they occurred and took made some changes in our processes and our procedures and have come, in my opinion, quite a ways in making corrections there. So when licensing came, it was based on instances that had occurred one a year ago and one about 8 months previously. So we have a number of citations, additional citations that we need to be making corrections with. We have started those. Some of those were reportable already to licensing. Some were in the process of making and will continue to do. I think the other thing that I would like to add is that during that period of time, which was a year ago, we still were operating with not very clear policies on restraint and seclusion. The reason for that was we had needed licensing to give us to authorize the policies that we had presented to them, and we hadn't heard back from them yet. So our staff were, honestly, not all operating on the same page. And the policies were not clear. The procedures that we were operating under were not clear. That was certainly one of the things that we identified when we did our own evaluation of those instances and worked very hard to try to bring our direct care staff in line or with the same understanding and direction as our nursing staff, as our medical staff, and clear communication up and back and across all those different disciplines. And again, I believe, because we've been meeting with staff, that what I'm hearing from my staff is it is much clearer, that they understand the direction. They believe in the direction we're going. And I think we've come a long way, but we will continue to welcome licensing to come in and scrutinize our program. We need to be transparent like that. So any questions?
Those divisions are separated in DHS. You're at arm's length from each other. The licensing division from the direct service division is a part of reorganization, which allows licensing then to come in and exercise its responsibilities.
Correct. That's correct. So the licensing responsibilities report up in the chain of command to Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson, who reports to the commissioner, and we know of licensing actions when they're taken. So we know nothing, you know, we don't know about them. In this case, we actually reported them. So we knew they were in process, but we have no opportunity to shape them or look at them or see them until they are determined and finalized by the commissioner.
Are there questions? Senator Hoffman?
Just one. Just thank you, Madam Chair. This leads to there's also some systemic issues regarding licensing. And I know one case, the Cambridge, it was 10 months that you operated DHS and didn't communicate to the Department of Health about licensing, and that was in the report as well. So what are you doing to assure that the cross systems and divisions within not only your but also with your partnering agencies that have oversight, what are you doing to assure that? Because if this was a private entity, I mean, 10 months, it would have been just off the charts, but I don't understand how we operate different than that. So,
Deputy Commissioner,
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, one of the programs, the what was the MEDO program, became Cambridge Mental Specialty Health Systems, and we went for a period of time without the health department's license. We maintained the human services license. We didn't change the name on the license, and the health department notified of us that us of that. Once we were notified, it was fixed. We again took a look at what was wrong with our system that somebody could miss not getting one of our facilities licensed when we made a change in either who we were serving or how we were providing the service. Again, we have now a series of internal controls in our system, and as of last session, there is now a requirement that the license holder, there be one single license holder when you have a series of programs. So it's not just the Department of Human Services that is impacted by that change in statute from last year. Every other provider, if you're a provider, private provider, and you run 30 different facilities, there is a single license holder who is responsibility for all of the licenses across your system. And so we're doing the same thing that everybody else is. That one person then has a series of sort of controls around her that assure, in fact, that that every facility has the right license at the right time, and those checks are done regularly.
Just a couple of quick questions there. The licensing permission that you talked about, took 10 months for licensing permission. It's some other time, not now, but as you do your systems analysis, is there this delays and lengthy periods of time that it takes to accomplish something in our systems that leaves the treatment staff vulnerable to confusion? I just really think that we have to understand what we've created in that line to make it impossible for it to function much more rapidly. Mm-hmm. Decisions should not be languishing like they are in the state system, because it just doesn't create an outcome for patients that we want. So maybe in the future we can talk more about licensing. I think there is a issue related to that. And I know... Thank you, Carol, for being here. I have met with you often and understand that you're putting your arms around and trying to grasp the complex and make the cultural changes that we're talking about here. So we have a responsibility to ask these questions and to get a sense of it. But I would also want to say, in context of this discussion, that there's been these people are change agents that are coming in to help make the changes that we're talking about here, for which you are not haven't been there or responsible for. And then I just have one more thing that we had a question here that I wanted to ask. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Nelson, and then I'll have a final question, then we'll go to the next subject.
Oh, thank you. Well, before we leave this report, I just this is very troubling to me. This is a scathing report, quite frankly. And it's very and I understand that it's a big issue and there's a lot of progress, perhaps, that has been made. But it's concerning to me that we have people in facilities that are not appropriate for their needs. And I just want to make sure that I had asked for, and maybe it's here somewhere, I haven't seen it yet, but there's two things, Madam Chair, that I would like to see. One is I'd like to get an identification of the services that the state-operated services provides that are not provided by other providers. In other words, those unique services that SOS provides. And on the other hand, I'd like, and then I'd correspondingly like a list of the services that state-operated services provides that are also provided by other providers. I think that's really important for us to drill
down. Where's the overlap and where
yep,
is the...
we need to see what that overlap is and then make sure that we're really focusing our resources where they're the most needed. And then just a follow-up on that, a report that's coming, those I think you called it the cause root or the root cause report about the gentleman who was released from St. Peter because of that missed filed report and then dropped off on a street corner. I just find that very troubling, I think. And so I'm asking, Madam Chair, that we would maybe you've already got it planned, that we will have a hearing to review that report.
Well, we did talk about that briefly, and, mm-hmm. and that root cause analysis is yet to come, and we intend to have an outcome on that. We're going to meet
you.
Again because we aren't going to get through all of these, so
thank
we'll
you,
have
Madam
another
Chair.
Chance to have this conversation, which I think is really fabulous. I would ask the auditor's office to come up and just give us a brief sense of how you see progress occurring. As Senator Nelson said, we're concerned about the findings of your report, and it's not that state-operated services isn't. I don't want to imply that, but we share the responsibility for oversight, and so would you help us understand how you see progress occurring?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I do want to thank the committee for having this hearing. I think it's important on an issue in an organization this large and that has an impact on so many people to follow up and make sure that these issues, and they were important issues and big problems, that there is progress on them. And I think that's what you're doing today. I will also say that there are some reports that we issue where there's a difference of opinion when we make our recommendations that we have with the agency about the best way to proceed. I think it's important to point out that when we issued this report, in essence, the department essentially agreed with all of the recommendations in this report. That doesn't mean, as you can see today, that everything has been fixed. Virtually everything here is in progress. And so we want to continue to track, but I think it is encouraging that the department shares a feeling that the recommendations that we made were a good path forward. One other thing that I want to say is that while I think it's important, and we try to do this, we try to kind of look at the recommendations and track what the department has done, but I think that in our office we also have tried to sort of resist a checklist mentality. In an organization this big, there can be new challenges that arise, new problems that may reflect things that we want to keep an eye on. And so we will certainly continue to watch the organization, try to figure out if there are, different things that we should be tracking as we go forward. One of the things that we will do next legislative session is try to put together a status report of our own and try to give you a better sense at that point of where we are in terms of implementing the recommendations, and we'll certainly be in touch with DHS to put that together. But I'm glad to see that so many things are at least getting the attention of the department. We hope to keep track of this and give you a better sense of that next legislative session.
Oh, fabulous. Did you introduce yourself?
Madam Chair, sorry about that. I'm Joel Alter. I was the project manager with the Legislative Auditor's Office for this project.
Oh, thank you very much. We'll look forward to that report, and maybe not now, but maybe the correct title from the licensing department. Is it Deputy Commissioner Johnson? Am I using the right? At the next time we gather, perhaps you could be prepared from the licensing division to talk about this the discussion around the temporary license. That the practice, it appears, that Carol Olson is going to be utilizing is reporting, is a deliberate transparency about what's happening, which allows us to monitor better. I think it's a fabulous policy. But we need to understand how that will be treated then by the licensing division. Well, is there just a continual temporary license because the new culture is to be transparent reporting and allow root cause and systems analysis of problems? So I would be interested in licensing division's approach to this new strategy that is being implemented in state-operated services. So thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, one more question, Deputy, or maybe would this be for Ms. Olson? I think so. May I ask you one more question? This is it does not have to be answered now, but just to prepare for the future. There is some concern expressed through NAMI that at St. Peter there's long periods of time waiting to see psychiatrists. I don't know if that's valid, but we would certainly like to know if there's a delay of psychiatry or psychiatric review. It may be that you're using alternative mid-level practitioners and the patients don't understand that that is a psychiatric intervention in meeting the need. But we would like to understand what's happening in terms of patient access and consistency of review for psychiatric needs, whether by a psychiatrist or an advanced practice nurse. And they're also concerned that other than medication, there's not much happening in the treatment program during the day. So some sense of understanding what happens from the patient's experience. Also really a sad sense that that they love the birds at St. Peter, and that the birds are gone. Is that true?
I'm not sure about that.
Well, there was this restaurant on the campus, and there were bird cages there. And I think the restaurant is closed, probably reducing access to the bird cages. I don't.
Madam,
I remember the birds from a long time ago, yeah. But.
In terms of the question about psychiatric care, Dr. Stephen Pratt, who's the medical director here, I don't know if you want an answer now about that, but he could address that better than I could. In terms of the programming, one of the recommendations in the OLA report was about to look at what is the best practice that should be brought forward, and we are forwarding a whole new structure around our programming at our hospital. And so that has already been initiated and is moving towards full fruition. And in terms of the birds, I will have to double check
okay,
on that.
Okay, thank you.
That restaurant did not close. It had a bird sanctuary in it, and the last I was there, there were still birds
okay.
there.
Okay,
I will
good.
Check on it.
I know those can be important. You know, we have about 45 minutes, and I really am concerned that we get to this other report, but Dr. Pratt is here,
Madam
and
Chair.
I don't know if we'll get you again. So,
Madam Chair, I just have a...
Yeah, yes.
Thank you. I just want to add on thank you. Your request here, if we could, you talked about advanced practice nurses and so on, but also physicians' assistants. Their use is used commonly so many other places. So I'd like to, if we could find out about that and have that added in.
Thank you, Dr. Pratt, for coming. The question was a concern about the lack of access to psychiatric services. They may be specific to a psychiatrist, but I think our interest is, you know, the appropriate provider for the scope of service.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And I will be glad to come back next time as well. Between the middle of December 2011 and the middle of February 2012, we lost approximately 7 full-time equivalents of psychiatric staff. I came on board at the end of January of 2012. Recruiting has been difficult. With negative news stories, that makes it more difficult to attract quality providers. I have hired 3 full-time permanent psychiatric nurse practitioners and 1 full-time permanent forensic psychiatrist. I have about another full-time equivalent worth of part-time psychiatrists who are consulting, and currently 2 full-time equivalent temporary nurse practitioners with 2 more about to come on board. I have all the units covered with nurse practitioners and consulting psychiatrists, except, well, there are 3 of the low acuity units that don't have a consulting psychiatrist right now. everyone has access to a psychiatric clinician. We are, I think, in compliance or this close to being in compliance with the timeliness of all our psychiatric documentation. When I started, we were way out of compliance, and it's been a long and arduous task to try and build up our psychiatric staffing and get that caught up. When I started, there were a lot of people who had not received adequate psychiatric care. Medications had not been well managed. There was a lot of very acute psychiatric issues going on there. I think that is pretty much all taken care of now. We deal with acute issues primarily when we have new admissions, and the vast majority of the people are well-treated as far as medications go. We have a lot of other things going on in terms of treatment modalities. Our documentation of those other things has not been as good as we would like, so we're working on improving our documentation and also increasing the amount of programming other than medications that our patients receive.
Thank you very much, Senator Kiffmeyer. Did you have a follow-up for that?
I do. I did not hear, and I don't know, maybe it wasn't possible, the physician's assistance situation on numbers, how many you have, and so on, and how
Dr.
they're
Pratt.
Used.
Thank you, Dr. Madam Pratt. Senator. We don't have any physician's assistants. I would be glad to have physician's assistants if we could find them.
So it's not a matter of discriminating against physician assistants.
No.
But you are utilizing mid-level practitioners, which I think makes a lot of sense, and it's the coverage, making sure coverage. We probably can come back at this a little more next time, because this was also another publicly documented situation in which the documentation was, it was not only non-existent, but, it's very hard to see how we're going to create measures and see whether or not our interventions are, in fact, creating the outcomes we want if we aren't documenting on a consistently regular basis the content you need to do the evaluation. So I understand, of course, the patients may have a longer treatment time than an acute episodic situation, but that doesn't mean we ought not be measuring progress much more frequently. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This is the last question we have to move on. I'm sorry.
Just a
we're going to move to another subject, which you're going to have a million questions about, too, I'm certain.
Okay. Well, this question it gets to the heart of the report that showed that there was just very little time devoted to the to counseling. And my question is, you mentioned the difficulty of hiring staff to perform or to lead that counseling. My question is, how many more staff members, whether it be for counseling or psychiatric care, do you think you need in order to meet the needs of the patients?
Madam Chair, Senator,
yes.
I was specifically referencing psychiatric clinicians. Mm-hmm. We hope to hire 3 more full-time permanent psychiatrists to provide direct patient care, and 1 more full-time permanent psychiatric nurse practitioner. In terms of other people providing counseling, psychologists, social workers, we have a fair number of them, and there has been a lot of that programming going on. We've also done extensive work with our security counselors to help them develop and improve skills at counseling. And there is a great deal of interaction that goes on between the people we serve and our staff day in and day out, minute to minute, hour to hour, that doesn't get documented. But it's therapeutic intervention on the part of our staff. And we are working on several things. One, how do we capture that and document it so that we can show that we are providing the necessary services? And two, how can we improve it and become even better? And in terms of staffing for other disciplines, I would defer to Carol.
Yeah, so we have actually done an extensive evaluation that started shortly after I came on board to take a look at all of the incidents that were occurring across the board. And we did this multidisciplinary. What were all the incidents that were occurring? What times of the day were they occurring? What was our staffing pattern on all of our units? And that was staffing patterns from security counselors to nursing to recreational therapists, social workers, behavior analysts, psychologists. Where were we lacking? And that has precipitated or has eventually led to some additional staffing positions, some additional therapists, an additional discharge social worker, some additional recreation therapists, some additional recreation therapy program assistants, additional security counselors, a shifting of our schedule that is now allowing for a shift overlap so that there's a lot of time for communication and additional education. You know, when you have a period of time in the middle of the day where you have half hour, 45 minutes, even an hour, where there's staff who can cover the unit and you can pull the rest of the staff off and you can do some additional training on person-centered thinking and trauma-informed care and illness management recovery. All of that has taken some time and is in the process of rolling out. We started our new schedule on September 11th. We started additional staffing or programming at the same time. We have treatment teams working together to really critically evaluate what are the risks that are still being presented in individual cases. How do we mitigate those risks? How do we help patients recover from their mental health issues that are still prominent?
This subject is of high interest to us, obviously, and it has multiple layers to it. And with your permission, Senator Nelson, I'll delay your question. Yeah. We're going to come back at this, and we just really have stolen time here from another report and people who are here to report on another thing. So if you have specific questions, Senator Nelson can ask them to you directly, but we will come back and look at these improvements that were being recommended by the auditor's report to the actual treatment of patients in these facilities, all of them. So thank you very much for coming. And with that, we have Rich Albertoni, Associate Manager of Public Consulting Group, who in 5 minutes is going to... and Chuck Johnson, the Department of Human Services Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations, who are here at our request. We thought we'd be able to go through two really significant reports today. This is a judgment error on my part, obviously. Senator Claussen.
Just a very quick comment. I serve on the Higher Education Committee, and one of the issues we discussed is a crisis in our mental health field. We do not have enough mental health workers. So we do have a summit that's going to be taking place in early 2014 to address that issue. We're getting all the stakeholders together from across the state to address those needs in that area. But we are aware that we do have a problem in our mental health workforce. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. I know that was a legislation passed last year to provide funding for that capacity building of understanding what our needs are, developing the workforce. This is a report on the value of Minnesota health care programs, managed care, as compared to fee-for-service. We are happy to have you here, Mr. Albertoni, to talk about this, and I'm hoping that you're able to give us a grasp of what the task was and what, without maybe the very specific outcomes, a general sense of what we got from this report, and we might be able to have some beginning questions today.
Sure.
And I'm very sorry that we should have separated these two reports, obviously, because they both have a great deal of meat in them for us to understand. So I appreciate your being here. I hope I can call upon you to come again if we find a need for that.
Thank you. And we do have a few minutes of prepared comments and a handout that I think is circulating. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rich Albertoni. My colleague Sean Katosky is here with me, and I'm an associate manager at Public Consulting Group. The Minnesota Department of Human Services contracted with PCG to report on the value of the managed care delivery system for the state's public health care programs. This was required under Minnesota Sessions Law 2012, Chapter 247, Article 1, Section 31. And I'm here today to provide a summary of PCG's findings. The legislation directed that the value of managed care be assessed in comparison to fee-for-service and according to seven specific criteria. And those criteria were health indicators, provider and recipient satisfaction, access to health services, the availability of additional services aimed at improving care, the potential of each system to deliver cost savings to the state, and alignment with healthcare reform initiatives, including the capacity to support alternative provider payment models. Overall, PCG found that Minnesota's health plans demonstrate a more developed level of healthcare coordination, performance measurement, and quality improvement than the state's fee-for-service system. The state's managed care system performs strongly in quality measures reviewed in the report and shows a greater capacity for quality reporting and improvement than the fee-for-service system. We also wanted to note that there are few outcome performance measures that are currently in place for fee-for-service. Where fee-for-service and managed care outcomes have been measured in comparable populations, fee-for-service lags behind managed care. The most widely recognized basis for comparison between managed care and fee-for-service health outcomes is the Healthcare Effectiveness Data and Information Set, which is referred to as HEDIS. HEDIS can be used not only to compare Minnesota's managed care and fee-for-service systems to one another, but it can also generate comparisons to other Medicaid programs nationwide. In 2011, DHS here in Minnesota conducted a quality comparison of its managed care and fee-for-service systems using 2010 HEDIS data available for comparable groups in both delivery systems and both programs. In that study, managed care outperformed fee-for-service on all 19 of the key HEDIS measures that were under review. Additional outcome comparisons between the two systems are limited due to the lack of common measurement standards, making a comprehensive comparative analysis of value between the two systems difficult. There are many elements of the two systems for which comparable measurement standards do not exist. This is due both to differences in the health status of managed care and fee-for-service enrollees, as well as the absence of effective fee-for-service performance metrics. Minnesota's managed care organizations also rank exceptionally high in access to care and patient satisfaction. One of the most important metrics for measuring satisfaction among managed care organizations is the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems, or CAHPS, which compares managed care organizations nationally on key satisfaction indicators. In 2010, statewide average scores for Minnesota's MCOs placed above the 90th percentile nationally in six of the eight CAHPS indicators, ranking above the national Medicaid HMO average in all of the measures and above the commercial average in all but one indicator. One area in which managed care provides significant additional value to Minnesota is in case management and care coordination. A number of MCOs have implemented population-based initiatives targeting critical health conditions, as well as performing community outreach to reduce healthcare disparities. Several of the health plans have also developed patient incentive programs and preventative care initiatives, along with enhanced transportation, phone, and online services. PCG found that both managed care and fee-for-service delivery systems in Minnesota show higher costs for seniors and people with disabilities than other Medicaid programs nationwide. These higher costs are associated with more expansive health plan benefits and also stronger quality indicators. For example, Minnesota ranks in the 97th percentile nationwide for preventative care for seniors. One exception to this broader trend of high quality at high cost is the state's public health care programs for child health, where analysis reveals below average performance on some health indicators for children. Minnesota's health plans are above average nationally in HEDIS indicators for child primary care visits. However, other key benchmarks, such as ongoing well child care visits, show that most health plans are performing at levels lower than the national Medicaid average. When paired with the per member per month expenditures for the child population, these quality indicators raise questions about whether the state is receiving optimal value for its spending on children's health. These outcomes represent exceptions to the otherwise high health outcome performance among the health plans. PCG also reviewed the compatibility of the state's managed care system with a number of health care reform efforts under the Affordable Care Act, such as the Medicaid expansion and the new health insurance marketplace. We found that both systems were broadly compatible with the spectrum of payment reform options currently being pursued in Minnesota, from patient-centered health care homes to total cost of care contracting and accountable care initiatives. In some cases, fee-for-service systems are more easily integrated into alternative payment arrangements, primarily because the state more directly controls payments to providers under a fee-for-service system. In other cases, health plans offer more opportunities to bridge continuity of care issues when a person switches from Medicaid to one of the qualified health plans in the new health insurance marketplace.
Would you pause there? I just want to integrate what you just said, and may ask you to repeat it. You're saying the fee-for-service, what you have to consider when you're talking about them is that the rates for fee-for-service, maybe you could just repeat that last comparison between fee-for-service.
Yeah, the last paragraph was really about how these two delivery systems can mesh with healthcare reforms that are forthcoming. And some of those reforms include things such as payment reforms. Now, what we see nationwide is that oftentimes fee-for-service programs are a very good fit with payment reforms simply because the state has more direct control over the payments to providers under a fee-for-service system. So that was the general comment about the linkage between fee-for-service and healthcare reforms there. Now, we also say in the case of managed care, an advantage with regard to how it meshes with healthcare reform is that you have plans, and if those plans also have plans under the health insurance marketplace, there's the potential for individuals to get continuity of care if there's churning between Medicaid and the health insurance marketplace.
So what you're meaning is that because you have control over the fees for service, you can make demands for those fees.
You can construct payment mechanisms very directly. You don't send a capitation payment to a plan that then devises payments to providers. The state directly pays providers under a fee-for-service model, so the state can directly control the mechanisms for payment to providers.
Thank you.
And actually, your question came just before I was concluding, so just about done here. But finally, the report also does recommend the continuation of the state requirement for HMOs to participate in MHCP as a condition of licensure. The report does document evidence that the requirement supports the law's intention to increase Medicaid recipients' access to strong provider networks. So thank you very much for your time and consideration, and we're certainly happy to take any questions you may have.
Great, thank you. Senator Nelson.
I just had a brief question on your fee-for-service comment as well. And did I hear you say that fee-for-service fits good with healthcare reform?
What we said is that generally there are different ways that both delivery systems mesh with healthcare reform. Payment reform is one type of healthcare reform, and in some states, we are seeing states using their fee-for-service model to advance payment reform because the state directly controls how providers are paid. They don't have to go through a health plan to make a capitation payment and turn around and have the health plan make the payment to the provider. So that's one component of healthcare reform that meshes with fee-for-service.
Just a follow-up question, Madam Chair. Well, I'd like you to talk a little bit about outcomes. If we're interested, I think we're interested in the outcomes and overall cost. And how does the fee-for-service fit into that as opposed to the overall outcome of the patient in looking at a different payment model?
Sure. So I think the handouts actually can help with that quite a bit. If people have these handouts. These are, again, we talked about the HEDIS measures as really the common accepted standard for health indicator quality. And what we have here on the first handout, the first slide, is a study that Minnesota DHS did in 2010 to compare two managed care programs that had populations similar to the fee-for-service program. In Minnesota, most of the fee-for-service population is currently persons with disabilities, as well as populations who are exempted from the managed care by federal Medicaid laws, such as Native Americans. There's other groups that are exempted from it. And then those who are just coming on to Medicaid and maybe having an initial period on fee-for-service before they enroll in a plan. But what this slide shows on the very left-hand side are the HEDIS scores for, according to these six HEDIS measurements. And you can see how they compare in the next two columns to two specific managed care programs that target similar populations. So you can see that the health indicator quality scores were higher in the two managed care programs, which are columns 2 and 3, than the left-hand column. Now, to the right, you see both the total managed care average in Minnesota and the national average. However, it should be noted that there are differences, very distinct differences, in the type of people enrolled in the whole managed care program, which is why these two particular managed care programs were chosen as a basis of comparison to fee-for-service, because there's similarities in the patient population. So the short answer is managed care showed better health outcomes than fee-for-service.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's Minnesota community measurements are also being used on the clinical provider level. Did you happen to take a look at those as well, or how does – is HEDIS the only measurement that you used in your research? Or because we also know that medical home, or in Minnesota healthcare home, has some measurements that are looking at transition and accessibility. Sure. So help me. I mean, there's all these different models out there.
Sure.
How you're rolling them into one?
Right. Well, HEDIS is a set of, it's sort of the gold standard of quality benchmarks nationwide, and it is a grouping of quality metrics that are put together by the National Council on Quality. And because there's widespread national comparison, we chose to focus on that because it gives us a broad sense of how Minnesota is doing in a nationwide context. So, yes, it was our focus, the HEDIS.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I had questions mainly about the terminology we use, and it's not your issue, it's what we call the things and so on. But of the managed care organizations you looked at, how many of them pay on a fee-for-service basis?
How many of them pay on a fee-for-service basis?
If I'm a doctor and I'm providing care to you under a managed care program, how many of them pay me, the doctor, fee-for-service versus capitation or some other system?
I don't have a comprehensive analysis of all payment types between managed care organizations and providers. Those We didn't document all of those payment arrangements within the context of the report. And part of it is we were looking at value, which is a combination of both health outcomes and cost. And certainly there's services that the plans provide that go above and beyond what a traditional fee-for-service model provides. But I don't have a way to give you a ratio of 50% or fee-for-service or anything like that within the managed care.
Senator Marty, would you you ask that question out of a context of something you're trying
to
understand?
Trying to get the context of the whole terminology. I mean, the two issues that struck me were one is talking about care coordination, what I think we think an MCO does. And I keep thinking I'm in a MCO and the clinic I go to is run by them. I think of my doctor and the clinic are the ones who coordinate my care, tell me when I should be showing up for this, when I need, I mean, routine things that tetanus shots, everything like that. It seems to me that that's what the doctor and the clinic tend to do, not the payer, not the insurance plan. And I'm just curious, I mean, that strikes me as a strange thing to say. One is managing care and the other, I mean, who's doing the care coordination seems to be the provider, regardless of whether it's, quote, fee-for-service or managed care, the two things we're comparing here. And the other point, the one I just mentioned, was it strikes me that we're saying one is, well, you use the term traditional fee-for-service, but it seems to me they're both paying, if I'm a doctor, I'm being paid fee-for-service, whether it's by the state, by DHS, paying fee-for-service because the patient comes through that, or if I come through Blue Cross or Health Partners or somebody else, they're still paying fee-for-service. It's just somebody else is paying the bill. Is that a fair assessment, or you say that's not? I'm just curious how, because that the whole report, given what you were asked to do, relies on there being some distinction there. I'm just curious if you see that.
I don't know that I'm in a position to tell you whether the health plans use fee-for-service payments as their dominant payment model. I think there's a mix of payment types going on, and I think the plans are experimenting with different payment types. I think nationwide what we as a firm are seeing is states starting to go beyond even what we might call traditional managed care and starting to look at delivery systems that can incentivize new ways for providers to deliver care. And that certainly is, I think, the next wave of delivery system reform that we're starting to see. So I definitely understand your point and see value in what you're saying.
Okay. Senator Marty.
To that, Madam Chair, I think that's part of the point, and that is that primary care case management, which you refer to and other things like that, whether who's doing the thing, whether it's the health plan, the managed care organization or the state, people are looking at all sorts of ways of paying things, but it's kind of irrelevant to whether, well, it's not irrelevant, but it happens in both circles, which is why I thought your comments on how they relate to health care reform is interesting, because they both have, states have plenty of ways they could do it without them, and they're doing it certain ways with them. It just strikes me when looking at the whole report and your attempt to try and compare the two is difficult, one, because you don't have numbers for certain things, and number two, because we blur the terms, because again, I would say one is not fee for service and the other one's managing, because, well, yeah, we pay a capitation as a state to a health plan, but the care isn't delivered by capitation. The care is delivered by a hospital or a clinic or a doctor or a dentist or whomever being paid by somebody. Usually, it seems to me, fee-for-service, whether it's the state paying it or a health plan paying it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question, Senator Hoffman?
Madam Chair, I just had a follow-up, and I'm so glad, Senator Marty, thank you for bringing the discussion on care coordination, because it's really, it can be confusing, because if not defining what care coordination is, we know, and in Minnesota did 10, 11 years ago, Dr. Jeff Schiff did a study on what medical home and having a primary care and a care coordinator, what kind of cost savings that is, not just in the sense of cost savings, you know, to the system, but it was more efficient and people with special health care needs and disabilities got their work done. But it makes more sense that care coordination be provided at a provider level. Again, going back to Minnesota community measurements, what I really wanted to get on is what are we doing to get down to the provider level to say what's going to work locally? And I think you're going there with that, saying it makes absolutely zero sense on the plan level to be a care coordinator because you're not devolving down to that local level. So I'm interested to dig deeper into this more, and I'm glad you brought that up. But care coordinator, we've got to make sure we're on the same kinds of discussions and definitions on that as well. And I would like to know, did you guys dig deep in the weeds on that?
Yeah, well, I think one comment to make on that is when we approached this report, we certainly recognize that there's a spectrum of care delivery, and it's not two points of comparison, which the authorizing legislation seemed to want to make it a managed care versus fee-for-service comparison. Really, now what we see, again, nationwide, is that there are lots of points on the spectrum of managed care, which involves health plans and increasingly different ways that providers are organizing and coordinating across provider types to coordinate care. In many instances, too, the plans are becoming more integrated with providers themselves. So there's a wide variety of care management models that are proceeding out there. And so I understand your point. And really what we were looking at is managed care in Minnesota, the model that it's operating under, versus traditional fee-for-service, which is really a model under which the state directly makes claims payments and there's not health plans in the mix to provide care coordination.
That was Rick Albertoni speaking, and what would help is that we identify for the tape who's speaking. That's why we like to have it come through the chair so that we can make sure that people are identifying themselves. Rich Albertoni, right?
Yes.
In line with this discussion, the report that you have goes through a variety of different ways in which reforms can occur, accountable care organizations, total cost of care. There's a variety of those described in here that are a part of the managed care approach. Mm-hmm. And those models are establishing a payment system to create incentives for a certain outcome. Total comprehensive care within either a contained cost, a capitation, or a risk sharing so that the provider can benefit or share the risk of not being able to create efficiencies in their system. Mm-hmm. Are those models, do you believe, being designed in a way that will not only create efficiencies, which gets to be more cost containment, which is important to us, but without using reduced access or reduced availability to services. You know, all of this in the past has been struggle about whether the doctor was going to restrict what you could have, and the doctor didn't want to be put in that position. So the managed care organization would review claims and not allow a certain procedure or not. The system seems to me to be moving this back down to the provider level. Those options that for a certain payment amount, if you're responsible for total cost of care, and if you can create efficiencies, you have an economic benefit. Is that my am I correct in at a very 50,000-foot level understanding those systems?
Correct. I think, again, we have a national perspective. We work with more than half the Medicaid programs nationwide. And I think what we are seeing is, again, a next wave of delivery system reform that goes beyond traditional managed care and focuses on specific populations within the Medicaid program, whether they're high-cost dual eligibles or whatever the specific population might be, and to try to look at what the specific delivery system needs of that population are that are unique, and to try to align delivery systems within the delivery system that addresses the needs of those populations more specifically. And often at the provider level to try to coordinate care for complex health cases where you really do need several providers working together. So, yes, I do think that the nationwide trend is moving beyond traditional managed care to look at more specific types of managed care for specific populations.
And as I see that developing in Minnesota, let's see if I can articulate the question simply. The provider group that wants to be an accountable care organization or whatever total cost of care system is asked to provide a comprehensive care system for a specific population. If they, as a group, do not have a particular specialty or aren't a hospital-based system, and they have to develop partnerships with those for the referral system, mm-hmm. They build this network of comprehensive care, and they are expected, in order to achieve the cost benefit of that system, to be efficient in those partnerships and in all of those relationships that they have. So they choose their partners based sometimes on the cost that those partners are charging, right? So is there anything that you see in Minnesota or elsewhere that shows that what is going to happen there, particularly in rural areas, is cost shifting, that the cost shifting If you're a clinic and you create a partnership with a hospital that's many, many miles away, because the one that's local is costs so much more and reduces the profitability of that casework, that you've now gonna let another part of the system be some distance away, specialty services, and you've cost shifted now expenditures to the patient, who now has to do extraordinary travel, extraordinary housing, or be away from family members. Are you seeing that our model is driving those kinds of activities at the provider level that create complexities for the patient?
It's a great question. I would just have to say that it ventures out really outside the scope of what we looked at, which was to try to compare the existing managed care delivery system to the existing fee-for-service system and try to assess the results the state is getting for those. So, it's a great question. I just don't feel particularly capable of giving you the insightful answer that on that question that I think you deserve.
Yeah, and there's the subtleties that we're not seeing when you're doing a comparison mm-hmm. Between this model or fee-for-service. And I was interested in Senator Marty's comment. I hadn't realized. I was thinking a fee-for-service is something where the patient really is in control and direct going to whom they want to, and you pay for the service. But you're saying managed care organizations can also use a fee-for-service model and then negotiate something with providers in relationship for that fee. Chuck Johnson is here, is the Deputy Commissioner for Policy. In operations, would you like to come forward and make your comments at this time?
Madam Chair, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to address this report today. I want to start with...
Would you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson, Minnesota Department of Human Services. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations. The report, cost added in the report, is largely based on data from 2008. I don't know if Mr. Albertoni mentioned that or not. I don't know if you haven't looked at the report thoroughly. You may not be aware of that, but I wanted folks to understand that, in part because, as we all know, we've done a lot in our healthcare programs since 2008. We put healthcare homes in place in 2008. We have, as I think has been referenced in this discussion, moved forward with our healthcare demonstration systems, which are really ACO-like, first in the country with the Medicaid program, but stretch across the fee-for-service and the managed care populations at a provider-level contract And we have 135,000 people in those right now. And, of course, we've done a lot in terms of changing the manner in which we contract with managed care organizations, competitive bidding, some of the changes we've made around how we treat administrative costs, and that continues to be an evolution for us as well. So when the report says that we are a high-quality, high-cost state, that is probably still true, but it's probably somewhat different formulation than you would have seen now than we would have seen from looking at 2008 cost data. In terms of quality, too, I'd like to point out that the Commonwealth Fund came out with a report last week that ranked Minnesota fourth in the nation on the quality of health care for low-income populations. So, again, there are other sources out there that see Minnesota as being a nation leader in the quality of care that we provide, both writ large across health care for all of our population, but also with low-income populations that we're serving, obviously, in our Medicaid program. The other point that I think Mr. Abeltorney did make about costs that I'd like to reiterate because it's important is that Minnesota has very extensive and perhaps the most extensive benefit set in our Medicaid program as you'll find in other states. So when you're doing comparisons to other states, that needs to be taken into consideration. That's a conscious policy decision that you all and we have made to try to have the comprehensive set of services available to low-income people in Minnesota. And it reflects in the cost, but we think it also reflects in the quality and the outcomes we're getting for people. We are concerned with the report's suggestion around the quality, the outcomes that we're getting with children in our programs. That is an area that seems to be a need for some continual work. I'm pleased also that the Council of Health Plans called that out in their letter, which I think you have in front of you as well, as an area that they see as a need for some further work to go on. We have been working on improving how we're tracking and getting the number of kids to their well-child visits. That's an ongoing project in the department that we've been focusing on, but I think there's a lot more work that can be done here with the managed care organizations, contractually through quality initiatives, other ways that we may be able to improve what we're doing with children. Generally, in terms of quality, I think that folks in the committee know that this has been a strong emphasis of this administration is purchasing quality, paying for quality. We've done that not only in healthcare, but also what we've done with the nursing facilities, with our home and community-based services, as well extending quality purchasing to that population with the child care program, a lot of other places. We've also partnered with Minnesota Community Measurement over the last few years to produce a report that really helps us focus in on quality measures, where we're improving, where we're not doing as well, and really finding there that the places where we do a better job is when we're partnering with the community. And so I think there's a theme there that we need to be looking at, I think particularly as we think about moving toward the work with children and doing a better job there. The report raises a couple of issues where we're currently working, and I think we'll see some more evolution going forward. One's related to the performance withholds in our managed care contracts. That is a tool that we have in order to incent quality, incent positive outcomes within the managed care organizations. We're working on being more deliberative in how we set those quality withholds. They've been a little bit over time, it's sort of accumulated a bunch of different measures that we use. We haven't stepped back and say what is important to us right now, and we're going to be doing that going into our 2014 measures and really working with what the community is working on, what ICSI is working on, what Minnesota Community Measurement is working on, so that we're all working together to try to improve in areas where Minnesota isn't doing as well. And certainly disparities is an area that we're going to be focusing on within that because it's a very key outcome area that Minnesota lags in, that we lag in within our programs. In addition, within the HEDIS data that Mr. Abeltorney shared with you, we're currently using a methodology for the HEDIS data that probably understates some of the quality performance that's going on. We've been working with the plans on looking at adopting what's called a hybrid methodology, which would probably give us a better and truer measure of how we're doing on some of those and would probably show some improvement in comparisons to other states. In terms of where we're going, I think this conversation has already started here amongst the committee. We don't really see this as being fee-for-service or managed care. It's how do we drive forward at finding new ways to purchase quality and purchase value for our healthcare dollar. Certainly the healthcare delivery service demonstrations that we have out there right now are a big piece of how we're trying to do this, contracting directly with providers, creating gain sharing within those contracts, putting outcomes into the contracts, and really working directly with providers across the fee-for-service and the managed care population at finding improved quality. We also have more work to do just in terms of the transformation of the fee-for-service system. as well, and trying to make that system better than it is now. We have a few places we just started some conversations about how we might do that, but again, not focusing just on fee-for-service, but focusing on overall how we're purchasing for quality. Certainly, as we move forward with this, the SIM grant that Minnesota was awarded last year from the federal government, a state innovation model grant, is a big help in this. It's a way to really help build the capacity of providers to engage more in this kind of value-based view of their work, both on the quality side and on the understanding of risk and purchasing. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, when you were talking about youth quality outcomes and so on, I heard a year ago or so from a psychiatrist who works in juvenile mental health saying that while we pay the health plans for early periodic diagnosis, screening diagnosis treatment program, that it's a very long list of things they're supposed to go through with each kid, and Medicaid requires us to do that, and we, like most states, don't do a good job of it. My question related to this is, we pay, I presume, in our contracting for the health plans for them to deliver the EPSDT services that are required. Do you look at, do they get them? I mean, this report wasn't getting into that kind of depth. We're paying for it already. I wonder, do you look into how many are getting the 100% of the screening they're supposed to? Or could that relate to the fact that kids are not having the kind of outcomes we want?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, we do have that data. We do look at it. I think that's part of what's driving the concerns reflected here in the report, but also our concern about where we're not doing as well as we should. The data, there's a little bit different ways to look at this data as well. One is sort of looking at how many of the well child visits are done, but also is looking underneath there and seeing how many actual screenings took place. That's another cut on the data that is actually what we report to CMS. They're more interested in that than they are in the well child. So we use that data as well to try to evaluate where we are, but I think that it's we haven't used it probably as proactively as we could to look for how we improve.
Follow-up, Senator Marty?
Just one general comment about this. I'm appreciative of this attempt to try and compare the costs. As they point out, it's a pretty tough thing to compare, but, I mean, I think after 20 years, our health plan system is still a demonstration project. In 20 years, we never really – this is the closest we've come to trying to compare them. And obviously, it's not an easy thing to do, but when you do something because it's going to save money I think there are lots of things happening. I think the Health and Human Services bill this year said we shouldn't be using our public dollars to reimburse them for their, quote, charitable contributions and other things like that. So I think we're making progress in that, but this doesn't really, to me, this doesn't give you any conclusion about whether this is a cost savings or a big cost. I mean, comparing it to we don't really have a fee-for-service system that makes sure that people get the care, the primary care case management type of thing. We don't really do that. This is the first anybody's tried as a state to compare whether we're getting a good deal out of this or not, and I'm not convinced that we're ever going to get those numbers, but I appreciate this effort because I think it's helpful information in here. But
one of the things that studies and research do is just help you provide the next set of questions. The next set of questions for the next. You have a set of questions that are narrowed by those, but then it just raises more questions. Oh, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question in regards to page 10 and 11, and maybe you can respond to this. I couldn't quite get through the whole thing, but it says that regarding costs, comparing the Minnesota Medicaid program, makes a statement that it's expensive when compared to other state systems, both for managed care and fee-for-service. Matter of fact, in the case of managed care, it goes on to say the retrospective analysis of the capitation rates have corroborated this conclusion as to comparisons with Medicaid expenditures nationwide. It was an interesting one that Minnesota ranked only behind the District of Columbia and New York in highest Medicaid expenditures per full benefit enrollee. And so, and then it goes on, when the two delivery systems are considered separately, each system proves to be high cost in comparison to other delivery systems of the same kind and other Medicaid programs across the nation. So it looks like here, I think the statistics actually kind of help us to give an overall picture, whether you're 1, 2, 3, 4, or top 10 or something like that. But we're just behind New York and the District of Columbia. So I think that's a fact that is an important consideration for us. And maybe you might be able to comment in regards to that.
Madam Chair and Senator.
Deputy Kiffmeyer. Commissioner, and I would just, before you respond, I think that when we were reporting on the report, there was a discussion of high cost, high quality, and in describing our programs, and that the cost has to be, the conversation about cost also has to be aligned with quality, because the state of Minnesota requires more of these programs, so it costs more if you require more. So these comparisons are, I need to hear these comparisons in relationship to something else rather than simply in isolation.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I think mm-hmm. that your observation is correct. Certainly this is a largely a function of the benefit set that Minnesota has that is more comprehensive than most other states, and the two was a D.C. and New York, I think, that were ahead of us. Certainly those are other jurisdictions with also very comprehensive benefit sets. And so it isn't surprising you see us at the top. I'm not positive, and staff could probably help me, but if this comparison includes long-term care as well, that's another place where Minnesota, particularly with – and I'm getting nods from the audience – with home community-based services, we have a much more extensive set of services available through our disability waivers and a much more extensive, you know, cost profile, frankly, relative to other states and what we invest into supporting seniors and people with disability in the community. And so that's probably part of what feeds into this as well when you're looking at those kinds of comparisons.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you're exactly right, and which it only leads to more questions, which is the only way you can do that is have alongside of it a benefit set so that you can kind of do that. So it always leaves you a little bit hungering for more once you do get this, but I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Are there other comments at this time or questions? The letter the Deputy Commissioner referred to, I think you referred to the letter from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, is among your materials for you to review. And I really appreciate your coming as well today. I think I would ask the committee members who are here to spend more time digesting this, and if you would like to come back at this again, we can provide some more time to sort of talk about the implications of what this study is or what other questions we might want to pursue. So with that, thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you for your attendance.
What's this? Oh, my colorful tape flies. Questions for this? Just as well.